I talked quite a lot last time about technology and the at present very popular viewpoint that technology is something that's been introduced to our life and on our planet here by human beings. That man is inherently mischievous and he's really made a lot of trouble for himself. I do not subscribe this at all, that everything that you will experience with me as we explore is consistently of discovering one principle after another that man has gradually, after another experience, he's been able to really identify as operative in the universe, whether it's the mass and attractiveness or the principle of leverage, whatever it may be. That these principles then, what the word technology is the knowledge acquired by humans of the regarding then the techniques of by which the universe has accomplished various extraordinary behaviors. So that the biology, we're learning how the bio, the zoological and the botanicals do develop. What are the structural laws that are operative and so forth? So that all this technology, the technique of the structuring and the associating, and the way in which energy is transformed from they're continually transforming. What are the methods of the transformations? And so I just like to get down that very simple statement that really feel very, I hope you'll feel strongly about it and find yourself in a position to counter when people talk about man as introducing technology and that this is something bad. But the universe, as I'm concerned, the universe is technology, and what man has been given as the capability of the mind over and above his brain to discover the technology. And to with power of the designer, he was given that capability, and therefore I assume it's power of the designer that he was supposed to use the capability. And that we're really discovering then that what has happened is a man in his fear and in his drive for hunger and his looking out for his own family, his own side, has then developed technology very early, very much as weapons. Though he did a great deal of technology in relation to learning how to pound the meals, the grain and so forth, how he can really convert various discoveries of nature into eatability. But I found, as I go through the anthropological museums, I'm sorry to say that really the biggest acceleration in technology seems to be in the way of the weapons. And the weapons possibly first, they are tools or instruments of killing animals, but they are spearing animals, or then they are spearing human beings. And great acceleration in our technology has been through the ages then in the development of weapons for warfare on the basis of the you or me meanness of the assumed inadequacy of the life support on board of our planet. Due to the man's being born ignorant and really not knowing enough about what is going on. But what has transpired and the great acceleration in during my lifetime has been the discovery of use of those principles first for war, then when wars are over, finding that an enormous production technology has been developed. As for instance, you have the water wheel going on. The waterfall was there all the time. Now you have the water running in the water wheel and it's operating an electric generator. And the energies are continually going then available over a wire to do work at great distances. After the war is over, something very different came in with World War I in relation to wars than had ever apparently entered in earlier. So we have biblically the phrase turning swords into plowshares, and that is really the simplest kind of phase of converting the war-developed technology to support of life that comes in afterwards. World War I is an enormous metallurgical war where human beings up to the time of World War I being primarily supported by agriculture and fishing. And we find the metals coming in, making it possible then to tin a steel can so that we could have foods preserved and not be contaminated. Suddenly this metals world entered into the picture, and due to the alloys and the metallic resources being situated around our planet very differently from where the agrarian advantage occurred, where things could grow. Very often the mines are just where things couldn't grow, on the great mountainside, Rocky Mountainside. So that we find that the World War I is a world war because the world's metallic resources are being brought into play over and above the agricultural resources, which were, every time the world came up to World War I, you took the farm boys off the farms to do the fighting. You used up the farm foods, you trampled down the farms with the warring, and when the wars were over, everybody was at very great disadvantage. And that came as an enormous surprise after World War I. And I always say that's World War. And it's World War because it's no longer just a local agricultural one. It's World War because you're using resources that come from around the complete Earth, which is metallic resources. And the technical information that come out of all history in all countries. And so there's suddenly then a roaring over life support for total Earth, and not longer just between two adjacent countries. And with World War I, we have, this occurs in the sequence of events of human beings learning about the technology of the universe and beginning to employ it. It is the first really great application of energies other than human muscle to the doing of work. Because by this time, we did have the electric generator, and it could be tied up to Niagara Falls and or other running waters. And in the time of World War I, humanity took out of the ground and put to work extraordinary numbers of metals, and in particular, copper and iron. Now, copper, as you know, is a very preferred conductor. It's non-sparking and conducts electrical current almost most efficient. Silver is just a little bit better, and gold a little better than the silver as a conductor. But there's not enough silver or gold to be used functionally as conductors or parts of electric motors. And copper was, while it is not a plentiful material, is plentiful enough to be functionally used. So that copper became then the handmaiden of the generation of electricity with the copper windings around the iron magnets. And they have the copper then became the conductor that carried this power to great distances and then be used again in the windings of the motors, where you use the power that had been brought by the conducting wires. In the 1 year, 1917, when the United States came into World War I began, as you remember, 1914, but 3 years later, the United States came into that war, and it was really drawn in by both the Allied sides in Europe. The Germans and the English tried very hard to get America in on their side because of the enormous potential productivity that was there. And during that 1 year, 1917, humanity, and particularly in America, mined more copper and refined it and put to work. In 1 year, the man had produced copper in the whole history of man, before cumulatively all the copper that had ever been produced up to that time, World War I. That amount was way outdone by the copper produced in 1 year, 1917. Due to then the copper being the essence of suddenly using energies other than the muscle of the man to do extraordinary work. When the war was over, unlike the farm wars where they said the foods have been used up, things have been exhausted, fields have been exhausted, men have been exhausted, suddenly with World War I over, the copper did not disintegrate, It did not go back into the mines. It stayed right where it was, and the waterfall kept on going, and so suddenly found that power was being generated and it was still being conducted to many places to produce work. So this is really the beginning of the technology and the technology of pouring energy onto levers other than the energy of human muscles or the muscles of horses and animals. And it is an extraordinary productivity that suddenly was there. As a consequence, many changes began to occur. As for instance, as we entered World War I, the number of human beings who had any economic success whatsoever, or any really hope of being able to carry on without doing some personal work themselves, was way less than 1% of humanity. And I developed some data to give me some insight in the changes that occurred post-World War I in relation to humanity in general. When we measure energy, the ability to do work with energy, the prime criteria of science through all the ages have been the ability to lift a given weight against gravity and a given height and a given amount of time. So you call it one foot pound per minute, or it could be one centimeter gram second. There are many different ways of expressing it. And as we get into electrical, we'll get down to joules, and then we get in down to kilowatts per hour and so forth. They're all intertranslatable in the terms of the centimeter gram second lifting weight against gravity. So there have been a number, since science then started measuring energy in such a manner, there have been a number of experimental investigations done of work that can be done by human beings in a given amount of time. And the investigation has been done primarily by armies of great countries. So German armies, Swiss armies, English army, American army, had measured the amount of work a healthy young 20-year-older could do with a given pack of a given weight and its own bodily weight. How much can he really climb in a day's work before he's exhausted? Going up a mountain grade, you'll be able to figure then the foot-pounds per minute that was accomplished in an angle like that. Able then to discover what the amount of average amount of work that can be done by a human being in a given day out of the amount of energy he's consuming, get a metabolic rating. That's metabolics being the conversions of energy into work. And we have internal metabolics that you and I just think about our digestion of foods and so forth. And we have external metabolics that we do with machinery by introducing energy to do work through levers. And the amount of work then we found that human beings could do, average healthy young man, we then were able to state it in terms of manpower's per day or manpower per year, cumulatively, how many days he carries it on. So that I was able to come to calculation of manpower per year by integrating the results of the experiments made by various armies around the world. And there seemed to be great consensus of opinion on power scientists about what this amount of work was. So I had a manpower per year figure. I wanted to use that in trying to assess the amount of work that could be done after World War I and consequently the amount of work that could be done before World War I by human beings using their minds and discovering principles versus using their muscles. We find now that there is relative efficiency used in engineering, using the word efficiency. And efficiency then identifies the amount of work you're getting out of a machine as ratio to the amount of energy you put in the machine. and again using the same methods of rating what the work potential is in the number of BTUs of heat. You can rate these things in different ways. But the efficiency then of a reciprocating engine, for instance, is about only 15%. The average of reciprocating engine is around 15%. You have a piston, and you have an explosion on top of the piston, and you send the piston in this direction. It has a connecting rod, and the connecting rod goes to the crankshaft. The crankshaft immediately contradicts. You send it this way by introducing the energy, and the crankshaft contradiction sends it back. So you lost all your momentum in this direction. This one reason why it's not very efficient. There's a little bit of a momentum because the crankshaft itself is has a circular motion, so there's a little momentum, angular momentum is called the behind the crankshaft going around, so it's centered. Now, we have another kind of engine we call a turbine, where we have then a connecting rod and an impelled surface. Instead of having explosion on top here, we have explosion on the side. An explosion being on the side sends it around like this, but it's restrained by a shaft. It's not a crankshaft, just a plain shaft. And the impelled element goes around at what you call a 90-degree restraint going out. So it does not contradict itself. Comes back again to be pushed a little more. And so your turbine is inherently about 30% efficient, about twice as efficient as the reciprocating engine. We have something like the jet engines with no connecting rods at all. You have your explosion, and you have the thrust, and you're working against inertia and displacement in this matter. We find then the thrust effectiveness of a jet engine without any connecting rod at all gets up to 60-65% efficient. Then we have ways of converting energy today that have been brought into play by the space programs, and we get into the energy cells. It is a chemical and electrical energy where you bring oxygen and hydrogen together and it releases energy. And we get up to about 85% efficient with this cell. And so there are very high efficiency that can be realized by humans by using the right technology. I found that taking the overall energy uses in the United States, I did these figures for Fortune magazine in 1938 to 40, and I was a science and technology consultant on their staff at the time, and I found taking the amount of energy is being used in America, the ones that, where the energy is going through, being used by reciprocating engines, versus turbines and so forth, and then getting down to the efficiency as related not just to the particular engine itself, but the way we use the engine. For instance, the reciprocating engine in an automobile, you have the drive shaft, then it has to go, the energy has to be changed at 90 degrees, go out through the differential to the wheels. Every time you go around a 90-degree turn, so well, like other energy, you lose a gradient of energy. The energy of that automobile engine then is greatly reduced from the 15% as it gets transferred mechanically to the wheels and goes through quite a lot of gears in the transmission box, so that takes up some more energy. As you drive your car, there's enormous tire distortion that has to be paid for by that energy and so forth. And we get to where automobiles as used get down to very low order efficiency, and at all times in America now, North America, that includes Canada and Mexico, there are over 2 million cars standing in front of red lights with the engines going. So we have over 2 million times approximately 100 horsepower being generated as they're idling there. So that we have something like 200 million horses jumping up and down going nowhere. And that we have to count that in our economy when we begin to get down. What is the efficiency of the economy? As I got into very comprehensive inventory of all the energies being used in America, I found that you could not credit the whole economy but more than 5%. We were only realizing 5 out of all the energies we're consuming. This figure still holds. that is today, out of every 100 barrels of petroleum we import, we put 95 down the flush. Just out of pure, many times, as I say, really poor and unavoidable and quite avoidable design decisions, where the decision to use a reciprocating engine on the part of automobile companies, simply this way they made money. They did not want to change their dies, their two wings. They've had the gas turbine for a number of years at very high perfection. Some of it gets used in trucks and so forth, but they're not like an automobile, because it meant they lose a lot of money that they could make. People didn't know this. That's great exploitation and ignorance of humanity. So I took in America, there also is a limit of the distance which you could transmit energy by electric wire. There's no way in which you can get energy from here to there to do work in any way, such quantities of such speed as by electrical conduction. So that pipelines and oil lines and trucks and tank cars, so forth, are relatively slow. So I find our economy really dependent on the electrical energy networks, how far you can transmit. 350 miles is all we could transmit up to the time of World War II. In a practical manner. You could send it further, but it involved so much materials and metals that you wouldn't have any other metals left over for other industries. So the operating choice had been this 350-mile range, which you brought about by saying you get more range, you have to go higher and higher in your voltage. And the higher your voltage, the more insulating problems you're going to have, and so forth. So that I took the energy networks, that is, we found that the energy networks were not close enough to each other, more than 350 miles between major ones, so that there were eastern seaboard energy networks at the time I was doing these figures in for Fortune magazine. I took the amount of energy being consumed in that energy network economy from all sources, from the water powers, the fuel, fossil fuels, the coal, the oil, the food being consumed by the people. And taking that total amount of energy being consumed, I then had to divide it by 20 to get it down to the 5% overall efficiency. That's all you're realizing. So taking the total consumed, like you could only get 5% out, so we subtract then the 95%. And what is left, I then divided that amount of energy, converted it into manpowers per year, because we had that figure. So I could then see what was the equivalent of manpowers effectiveness actually operating in our economy. It is a very sad fact that in the United States, this sad fact is revealed, but if you go back in the record, with the revolution and 1776 and so forth, the first census of the population in the United States was taken in 1790, just after the war was over. In 1810, the United States Congress decided we ought to have a census of the wealth of America. So the Treasury Department had a very large survey made of the people to determine that wealth. In 1810, there were 1 million families in America. In 1810, there were 1 million human slaves in America. This is, I said, that's a very sad and very dramatic fact to be revealed as you go back in those records. Anything but it looks like an average, every family having a human slave. That was not correct. Very few families had owned the slaves, comparatively. But the point is that that kind of a figure. So I found that in 1940, contradistinction to that kind of condition, that there were a number then of energy slaves working in the economy rather than human slaves. And I found that you can go back and look at that Fortune magazine 10th anniversary issue of 1940, and you find the numbers of energy slaves operating per each person or per family. The number of energy slaves per person in the United States was 39 energy slaves per person. As every individual, if it had families of five, we then got up into pretty close to 200 slaves working for each family, but any of the slaves, completely inanimate, in contradiction to a million, one slave per family of a human slave. You suddenly have 200 non-human slaves doing the work. Enormous step up in the advance of the living that it represented, as well as doing away the inhumane idea of the human being the muscle machine to be commanded. That change had taken place in so short a time, really. I was talking about 130-year change. I felt that I was discovering something very, very dramatic. Now, I took then the criteria, I went into the figures in 1940 even more deeply, because by then World War II was thoroughly looming, and a great deal of the energy being generated in the United States was going towards war productions. So I deducted from the total energy that I would be considering any energy that could be identified as going towards anything to do with war, to see how much energy then was actually benefiting the family, the human beings. The energy is producing a highway for them to go on. I made that primarily for them and not for the war, whatever it might be. I made it as strict an accounting I could see what was really benefiting the family. So then I found how many net energy slaves are really supporting a peaceful life of human beings in America. And then I found 100 energy slaves per family, approximately. I gave you 200 at the time, 100, about half of them then were really working for the human family itself, and the other half were working for getting ready for war. So I took the criteria of 100 energy slaves per family as being the criteria of what I call a have family. And this represented people really enjoying a very, very comfortable standard of living. So my criteria of a have family, 100 energy slaves per family. Now, in 1900, nowhere, taking the total human population, far less than 1% were what I call an industrial have families. I use the word industrial have. Incidentally, I use the word industry in connection with the technology, and I've also found myself being mistaken or misunderstood with the word industry a great deal over the years, and because I'm going to give you a good definition of industry in a few minutes before I follow through on this, but I find the word industry being identified also with the exploits, people trying to make money rather than how to make the world work. I use the word industry, and I'll show you later on in a very distinct way. It is an anthropological way. It's a really biological way to explain it. I use then the word industrial have family, 100 inanimate energy slaves working for it, specifically for its comfort and life support and increase in degrees of freedom as its inquiry and movement and so forth. So less than 1% of humanity in 1900. As a consequence of World War II and the technology I spoke about that was introduced with World War II, as we came out, 4% of all humanity was suddenly industrial has, which was a very big jump from nothing. In 1951, I was taking a new point on the curve, and I found that we'd gotten up to 28% of humanity. I had now enough points on my curve, I had 3 points to be able to discover what a radius, there's a radius of change. So I made it a constant radius of change. And I extended that radius, and I found that the curve was increasing so rapidly that the curve, in exactly 2000 AD, we came to 100% of humanity would be enjoying this high standard of living. I saw that curve could be accelerating, so I made an acceleration curve on my 1951 publishing of this curve, but I took the slower rate of just the constant rate of radius. And I found that as of 1970, the curve went through 50% of humanity. Historically, the 99% and more percent of humanity were have-nots. They were in dire need, and revolution was really rampant. And the many would then say, the few are enjoying unfairly, and we must get them to do something about it. When you go by 50%, I saw for the first time in history, the majority begin to be haves rather than have-nots. This would really bring about a very different way of looking at things. Those who are have would probably find it much more information they had than they ever had before, that finally they really couldn't enjoy the haveness as long as there's awareness of the dire have-notness of the others. I felt, at any rate, this would be a critical point where, for the first time, we would not have the majority rising up to pull down the top. You might really have then the tendency of the majority being on top to pull the bottom up. This seemed to me probably a very new volition. So in 1951, I marked on my chart the critical year would be 1970. Usually my acceleration could be somewhere between 1970 and 1975. The most accelerated point was 70, and the least accelerated was 75. So I marked then, this is a critical period. And it really came in. The curve did get to exactly there at 1970. So we've been going through a very, very critical time here now. Because there's this point where, I say, is now being clearly demonstrated to humanity that something is going on if he is not so myopic and short-sighted as not to really look at such curves. I'm really astonished how little people really look at them. It was this kind of awareness that made me want to develop what I call a world game to try to make it as quickly as possible clear to all humanity what its options were, that changes are going on. There are very big things going on in nature here. I said I also was going to identify the word industry with you, which I'd like to do now. I spoke to you 2 days ago about human beings being not just halfway between the biggest and the littlest known biological species, but that we were in the middle, that all the other species were distinguished by having an integral distinguishing equipment for special environments, that the human being was in the middle and had the capability to sense principles and employ the principles that, so he could go into any kind of environment. He could go under sea or in the sky, whatever it might be. He could get out of the atmosphere. That he had then this particular kind of distinction. Now I'm going to look at other biological species again. And I'm going to identify behaviors of various organisms where we find in the fundamentals of the great second law of thermodynamics, where energy is being given off by systems. The energy is given off by the systems, automatically being given off, get into the environment and alter the environment. So we find all systems really, at all times, altering other systems. This is the very essence of evolution. We find that organic creatures take on more energy and employ more energy than non-organics, and they give off more energy than the inanimate metals and so forth. So that the living organisms alter the environment a little more than the non-biologicals. The altered environment then calls for new adaptability. biochemist Waddington of Edinburgh University talks about this as the epigenetic landscape, that the environment is changing the environment. And find that there are a number of biological creatures that alter the environment in discrete ways rather than in a random way. Energy is just given off and bring about very random conditions, as you can understand. and due to the fact that the environment itself is changing, the energy given off, they're not in any synchronization with it. So there tends to be a disorderly interaction between the environments, the energy being given off, and the environment. There are, however, creatures that alter the environment in very discrete ways, so that human beings can immediately apprehend that one of these other organisms is in operation there, such as a spider's web. That is, they alter the environment in ways that are actually disconnectable from their own integral equipment. And yet the altered environment, external, extracorporeal, that altered is necessary to their survival. We find none of the creatures really have two parts of their survival, an integral equipment and an external equipment. So the field mouses run through the grass of the little tube, or the moles run is part of his survival equipment. So he is a miner, and the miner is part of the mole. We find then there are increasing delicacies and intricacies of the alteration of the environment by the individual creature. As for instance, we have the bird, and the bird's unique function is its ability to get on in the air. And in order to be able to fly, it has to do the most with the least. So the bird is designed to take on relatively small amounts of fuel at fairly frequent, high frequencies, so we never get overloaded with fuel, not big fuel tanks. So its weight will be kept down. And the bird cannot have the young bird in it gestated in its womb, because it gets so overweight, it could not possibly reach those small fuel. The energy inputs are going to need to reach an insect, couldn't fly anymore, it's too heavy. So it would starve, and the new life would starve. So the bird is designed in such a manner that the development of the new life is affected by a beautiful design, which then the chemical nutriments are secreted to surround an embryo in an egg, and the chemical ingredients on board to crush that egg and get rid of it, get it out quickly. Then the bird's captain produce nests, and they produce in many ways. A very typical one of the migrating birds is the male birds will migrate northerly earlier than the female birds, and the male birds flying can identify the kind of terrain and growth where the kind of insects or worms that particular bird lives on would be in plenitude. And picking the most favorable places for that, they then come in that area, and the male birds take positions in the trees. They have omnidirectional positioning, not on highways and just working linearly, but omnidirectional. So take positions in trees. And you see two male birds of a given species from time to time coming down on the lawn, and a little fight going on. What they're doing is taking position in the trees and then making trial sorties of the distance that the mother bird will be able to go from the nest as she leaves the egg without letting the egg get too cool, because there's a very limited range then of the sorties. So the male birds find out whether in going after the food they're going to need, what is the range from that nest, and they find two males find that they're ranging, is running at each other, then they spread out of the trees a little more. Because they haven't built any nest or anything, they're simply taking position in the trees, so they get that geometrical interpositioning really like closer pack spheres. So each of the spheres, they having a radius of the range which the mother can go. So we find them then developing the nest, and the nest is really an extension of the womb function. And the nest is an insulator, and the egg is in it, and the mother sits on top of it to close the sphere around it to make an artificial womb. And then the mother must give the egg heat, and heat at a very specific rate. If you give the heat to the egg too fast, it's going to boil away and have a hard-boiled egg. You have to get the egg at exactly the right rate, And the mother's designed to get it's designed the whole thing designed for the byproduct heat coming from that mother to keep that egg just right in that nest. So she's able then the nest will hold the heat enough so the mother can make that sort to get back there before it gets out of critical heat balance again. Extraordinary piece of design. We get to the ecological design is exquisite. You find each of the birds, the species, designing different kinds of nests, and that's something called a bird's nest. And you can tell an oriole's nest right away from a fishhawk's nest, whatever it may be. They will use beautifully the weaving and the things that go on in producing it. And so I find, however, that the oriole doesn't change its design. And once in a while, in the new world where we have nylon stockings, they get a nylon thread instead of a piece of cotton thread of yesterday. And so the nest may be a little stronger, but the bird didn't do that purposely. It's not really part of the volition. We don't find any of these species altering their extracorporeal to do. It stays absolutely highly distinguishable and ready, you and I can identify very, very properly. I find then the many biological species that have extracorporeal, these are artifacts, these are tools. The nest is a tool, an artifact. And it is an environment alteration that produces a favorable environment external to the bird. I find that human beings are not at all unique in developing tools or having the capability to alter environment to bring about preferred condition for that particular species. But man is very unique in his ability to discern principles and to alter the design of the artifacts. That's why we find him different from any of the other species again. I find then, I have something, these artifacts, extracorporeal, but it's part of the species itself. Well, how simple to say, nest is part of it. And the fact that attached is no longer, is irrelevant. Now, we then see that human beings and their tools, are, even though they change their design, the tools are really part of the human being. So he has a very, he's a very interesting kind of species. He's really evolving quite rapidly in his external tool producing. But he can only produce what nature permits him to produce. It has to be completely proved technology of universe before he can ever employ the principle. I find that most distinguishing of man's technology from the technology of the universe is its relative crudity. It is only operating at a 5% when he could be operating at 85%, whatever it might be. So that I see that as also part of his learning, that he's born naked, helpless, and had to find his way. So I can see he may come to some critical mass condition where he suddenly has enough information to behave a little differently from the way he does in his sphere. Those are the kind of things I keep looking for in these kind of curves of great change. I said, Andy, it was absolutely implicit in that curve that I gave you of the increasing haveness that we were coming to a point where all humanity would suddenly be complete have, and whatever the great struggle, all the raison d'etre for all wars, for all politics, would go. If he could survive through that period while he's learning, whether he'd blow himself to pieces or not, because many a species dies, and many an individual dies. He'd been born to be successful, but somehow or other has not employed the totality in the way that makes it successful. So I said if he could make it, he would suddenly be in a totally new relationship to the universe, where the consideration would never be you or me. Be just very spontaneous. What needs to be done, and how do we do it spontaneously? What do we need to know more about principles to do it effectively? Well, the kind of nonsense of the money making I gave you the other day was for the honey money built and drive would then become just as obsolete as the umbilical cord when the child's out of the womb. Doesn't mean it wasn't good at his time. So I, in no way am I condemning what man has done at all. I just want to see what it is he's passing through and trying to see if I can find any date on which he might get here. But there's no instant anything. We don't have instant universe. We simply have gestation rates, and all of them have to do with really very proper development, proper fitness. And the kind of transition we're talking about is something that had to take millions of years. Already has taken, with no man being on board our planet for 3 million years. But we're just suddenly coming to some kind of epitome of the information gaining where we're supposed to behave very, really very maturely and with utter integrity. And not in the terms of the negatives of fear and so forth. Now, coming back to the tools, and human beings then being tool makers along with other creatures, and having capability to mind, to apprehend principles, and to alter the tools very much in pure principle, and able to get into all kinds of environments and been able to perform and get on effectively. We have then those human beings with the extracorporeal tools. So I find that all the tools of humans, I'm going to get just a class of humans and their tools, all the tools break down into two kinds of tools, what I call the craft tools and the industrial tools. The craft tools are all the tools, inventions, devices that can be discovered and improvised by one individual starting nakedly in the wilderness. The little boy going along nakedly in the wilderness kicks a stone, incidentally, and realizes a stone can be kicked in the preferred way. So then he finds he can pick it up and throw it in a preferred way. And he finds he can hit something. His arm's longer than he thought he was, because that stone will hit it. And he finds he can pick up a stick and it becomes an extension of his arm, and he can knock something down off a tree. These are things he can do absolutely starting nakedly in the wilderness by himself, kind of information, and what he does spontaneously in satisfaction of his hunger or whatever it may be, his curiosity. So I find then all the great heaps of artifacts around the world are primarily then craft tools. It could whether it's a fishing pole or developing a bow and arrow, a sling, whatever it may be, making a crock. This is all done by the individual experimentally. He can arrange those conditions. So the enormous heaps of artifacts of history are all craft tools. Now, I define the craft tools. I have an absolute sharp differentiation between craft tools and industrial. The industrial tools are all the tools that cannot be made by one human being. It just would not occur. First, it's a great giant dynamo, this piece of machinery here. It involves incredible thousands of people doing the mining of those metals, or it is a very complex production. So these are the industrial tools. These are the tools that represent the cooperative efforts of very large numbers of human beings, both in the information gathering that went into it, as well as the actual production efforts that there may be. That's very sharp. Industrial, all the tools that cannot be produced by one man. I want to think then all those heaps of artifacts are the ones that could be produced by one man. And this industrial one is a very new one. Now when I have my definition of the industrial tool versus the craft tool, I come to a very interesting discovery, which is that the first industrial tool of man was the spoken word. It required communication between human beings. So instead of saying the beginning was the word, I said the beginning of industrialization was the word. By virtue of this, human beings could integrate their experience. I'm sure there's communication, there's pre-sound words of man, of gesture, no question about it. But he had to be able to communicate. This communication then is from one to the other, where you compound your experience. This brings about this industrial tool. Okay, now, again, then the industrial tool, and with this absolute clean cleavage between the two types, and it begins giving great insights. Now, you understand how and why I find it a very misinformative, belittling, to speak about industrialization only in the terms of a corporation making money, where a relatively few may own shares, they gamble and put up some capital and buy some equipment made by incredible numbers of human beings, and they find ways of turning the productivity of the many to the advantage of the few. This goes on must not in any way let us lose insight in the fundamentals. So the industrialization is absolutely fundamental to the universe, and the technology absolutely fundamental. And it's how do we use the information and all the integration of the information we are getting by virtue of those words that makes it possible then to, and with the written word, you could communicate from generation to generation, suddenly able to compound. So I find industrialization is then the, in conversation of the craft. The craft is inherently local, inherently limited. It's limited to that little individual, the length of his time, his life. The different parts of our planet are very, very different. So he might be born, if he's in the South Seas versus being born in Finland, the conditions are very, very different. That little individual just had little legs, and he only covers a certain sweep out of area in a total lifetime. He doesn't have time to see how much room he can cover. So much of the time, picking up food. And he knows there's some back there. He stayed pretty local. Human beings then, the craft tools are inherently local and very limited. Limited lifetime. The industrial is inherently comprehensive, embracing all the information gained by all human beings that have been communicated one to the other in all the history of man. So the leverage advantage, what we can do industrially versus what we can do in craft, is just incredible. Again, I shudder when I hear people talking about industrialization. We must go back right to craft now, so we can't do anything. We give up words finally, because the words are most beautiful technology. This is obviously you're racing into oblivion very rapidly. So I see this extraordinary designed accumulation of incredible information, the extraordinary capability that's been developed for you and I to sit in this room. It's nighttime, but there's light. All colors are light, and that we are making a recording of what we and I are thinking together here, so it can be communicate. This can be sent around the world 186,000 miles a second. For every way we read, it can be truthful and thoughtful with the reality of our moment, realizing our reality is one we know very little about. We're just trying to be absolutely truthful as we can. These are things we have to go on. So I must be very sure that you understand my word, how I use that word. And that we're trying to find how we avoid the fear and the ignorance of looking out for me or looking out for my side that brought about the money making and the exploitation that brought about this negative viewpoint of society regarding its technology and the enormous extraordinary contributions of all humans all before us to this moment which we exist. Our responsibility is very great. Incredible responsibility. Now, I say, you know, the ignorant man can do things that are seemingly very offensive. The people who do what to me are rated by society as very offensive, I say they have to be very, very innocent to do it, because otherwise they'd be too embarrassed themselves. There have to be a lot of sensitivity has been shut off in one way or another. They've been starved of sensitivity, whatever it may be, that such things could go on. I'm going to veer away from what I've been giving you, which is really, it's very generalizable. What I'm talking about could really go on other planets, other biological conditions, other biosphere conditions, where there needed to be a local sensing organism. There could be some kind of organism that might get on at extraordinary heats that we could not get, our kind of organism couldn't get on at. Well, we're being designed primarily in this hydraulic designing. So maybe it'd be some other kind of liquids, maybe mercury for blood or something like that. There are ways in which designs could be accommodated for any part of the universe where local sensing organisms could be operating and might be then have been given the same access to generalized principles, the capability to apprehend relationships between and not ours. Otherwise, I think the monitoring that can go on would look very, very different than any other part of the universe. I'm now going to seem to change subject fairly abruptly, but not really so. So I like to think about the human organism, the human as a design, and see if we can find any other discrepancies where society is prone to make this explanation. It's an easy way to want to talk and say, well, the explanation is a little different. I mentioned earlier human beings then having a proclivity to want to explain things monologically, so they would like to find the building block. And one reason why they probably, the Platonists and so forth, did not really realize that you would combine your tetrahedron and your octahedron to fill all space, and that the space filling was inherently complementary. I said, we only have complementarity come into physics in 1922. We don't have the knowledge that the complementaries are not mirror images of one another until Nobel Prize given in 1956. Very, very recent there. So, you and I know that, and we can think quite differently when we look for these complementaries of one another. Now, human beings long, long ago evolved words for concepts, and there's certain concepts that I find are very, very important to reconsider very thoroughly. I have something I call a pattern integrity. And I find that pattern integrity is something operative independent of the local phenomena that informs you and I of the presence of that pattern integrity. And here's the way we're going to find ourselves on an experimental basis what I mean by pattern integrity. I'm going to take a manila rope of a given diameter and given number of strands, and taking a piece of nylon rope of the same diameter, same number of strands, I'm going to splice the nylon into the manila, the end of the manila rope. I'm going to end of the nylon rope, I'm going to splice in cotton rope of the same diameter and same strands. I'm now going to take a hold of the end of the manila rope, the beginning end of the manila rope, not the spliced end. And I'm going to lead it, I'm making a circle like this, make one circle, one complete cycle. Then I'm going to make another cycle with still holding on to my rope. And I hold on to the circle I've already made, hold that in this hand, and I run my rope through the, I make another circle in another plane. If I were to make a circle in one plane, then another plane, and a circle in the same plane, it becomes what you call a coil. But when I make one circle in one plane and then another plane, with meeting the end through it, I have then what you call an interference. And that is the simplest known knot. I now have two ends of the rope with this interference of one circle with the other. And if I pull on it, the knot tends to contract. It gets to be a very interesting condition to the universe, where we find there are the mass interactionnesses of the those islands, of spherical islands of planets and so forth. So when the two are pulling one another, if one of these interferences occurs, then it makes things get tighter. So this is the thinking that goes into Einstein's thinking about energy as mass. But the energy then gets tying back, interfering with itself, and tying itself up knots. In contradistinction, energy being released radiantly. How can it knot itself up? By interferences. As you look to the tense segregated structures of me, there must be a closure, must come back to itself. These are interference patterns of producing inter structural stabilities. These interference patterns. Yeah. That spliced set of ropes, manila, nylon, cotton, I'm going to make them knot right just loosely. I'm not going to pull on the two ends. I've got it on the end of the manila rope, and now I'm using my hand, closing it around the rope. I'm going to shove the knot along, keep massaging it along. So I just massage it till it gets to the end of the manila, and now it goes along the nylon. I keep massaging it along. It goes off the end of the nylon under the cotton. I keep on massaging, finally goes off the end of the cotton. Disappears. Now, the rope didn't do anything itself. My hand led the rope. And my hand did what my brain and my mind asked it to do. I had a pattern that I was familiar with, and I wanted to explore that pattern. So I'm responsible for the pattern. My mind is actually visualizing what I did in that patterning there, not what my hand did, not what the rope did. Now, what I've learned here is I did what moved this knot along was that the knot could not be identified as being Manila. Though it was a Manila knot that told you it was a knot. So I massaged it along, suddenly the nylon is telling you that it's a knot. Now the cotton is telling it. But that is what I call a pattern integrity. Its presence being communicated to you and I by virtue of its interfering with and doing certain things, things that you and I can apprehend. And we have the tuning capability to see rope. There are a lot of things we can't see. Many things going on in this room here, the electromagnetic waves going through the room we can't see. This is one of the things we can see. We have tuning capability to see that yellow of the Manila or the bluish white of the nylon. Next thing. I got a stone in the water and a beautiful circular wave emanates. I try it in milk in the same way. And I try it in kerosene. I said, I've been thinking this wave, I call it a water wave. They said, maybe it isn't the water, maybe it isn't the milk, maybe it isn't kerosene. We've got to find out more about it. So now we scatter sawdust very nice and evenly on the water. It's a still pond here, and just scattering out so evenly. Then we drop a piece of red popcorn in the middle of that of the floating sawdust there, and then we take surveyor's transits and on three different angles at that red popcorn. We have moving picture cameras, which are both above and various sides. We have a number of observers. In fact, we have all the degrees of freedom because we have enough cameras then for the six positive, six negative. So now we drop a stone in the water over here, and the wave goes into the sawdust, and you see the yellow sawdust wave, and the red piece of popcorn is fired by these instrumentation. Moves outwardly from the center of the earth inwardly and comes back where it was. Didn't go anywhere. So it had been part of one of the waves as it went along, you thought. Now, we find the molecules of water in exactly the same way, and now I've been very clearly identified. They operate not exactly a perfect perpendicular, but a very, very narrow and delicate ellipse. Come right back where they were. They don't go anywhere. So what went from here to there, you can see the wave go from here to there, but the water didn't go anywhere, so the wave had to just go by itself. Just as the knot went along on the rope, the rope wasn't going anywhere. So I begin then to discover that a wave is in a pattern integrity in its own right, and I want to know more about it. So it was a nice, beautiful day, and we go down to the harbor, and there's no wind blowing, and lovely blue sky and the clouds. You look there at the water, there's lovely boats moored out there. And the reflection of that boat, there's its hull and there's its mast, and there's the blue sky and the clouds, all mirrored in the harbor. And so suddenly we saw something in the water. And the mast of the boat does this, straight out here. What happened was then that the radiation from the sun coming through the atmosphere of the Earth, gets bent into the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violets. So there's a blue sky, which is effective of that radiation being bent. And there are the white clouds and all the green trees, the yellow of the ship. These are all colors within the very small amount of the great electromagnetic spectrum that is visible, attunable by man. So those are frequencies that you and I have the tuning capability for. So what happens is that tuning capability with which we have the equipment, plus after image, it's a very strong thing, this brain relationship of storing the special case, the rate in which we can recall, after image tells us that the mass did this. We got a little scenario. So the information which you and I can tune in, or the red and yellow and blue of the sky, that size wave that you and I can tune, gives us information compositely of the presence of a wave you and I can't tune. And this is a step-up and step-down transformer of information. But I want to get at the point then that the fact that you and I say we can see a wave in the water, we don't talk. We see the blue sky, we see that other kind of waves. We see blue waves and yellow waves and white waves. We're not seeing any the wave of the water. But we're getting information about it, do the after image, very strict memory thing, get a very fast approach of that memory thing. We caught on that wave is present. This already happens when we then started, electromagnetics got into a radio set. We began to pick up waves a mile high. That's the first law. First radios were all mile waves. Pattern integrity, okay? Now I'm going to come back to trying to think a little about you and I. I find human beings playing a game over the great ages called Animin and Anna. They had 20 questions. And you play that in all kinds of radio games, or television games today, but the first question that an astute person would ask the person who knew the answer would be, is it animate or inanimate? That's got rid of a great many irrelevancies. I spoke to you yesterday about thinking getting rid of irrelevancies. So it gets rid of a great many irrelevancies. We then assumed animate and inanimate were physical objects. That the physical was either animate or inanimate. And quite clearly, warm, soft flesh was absolutely different from cold, hard metal. And so those never should be confused, the inanimate and inanimate. But gradually man began to learn a little more, getting much more and more specialized. And before I finish today, I'm going to get back to talking about specialization. And right, we find man learning a little more about his total experiences and beginning to realize that there are biological species other than just biology, or just named Byrne, or just my friend in the sky. Began then to have these different species identified and began to gradually get into such information as where it has to have the word biology. We want to differentiate between the plants and the other creatures. Zoological. Now, with biology, as I came into the world of biology in the century, man had no idea of any relationship between of biology with chemistry. There's little known about what the chemistry of the biology might be, but it was not thought really in the chemical terms. And there was chemistry. And chemistry was dealing with invisibles and was doing things experimentally and discovering things invisible. It was only the time of World War II, that recent, by which time I am 50 years of age, that a man found he had more and more powerful instruments, better and better microscopes. And there were more and more specialists coming in, and they didn't want to be exactly on top of one another, so they kept taking a little more surrounding territory. There were so many specialists in biology, so many specialists in chemistry. But suddenly, with World War II, it came the knowledge that they'd overlapped. And thinking they're going to be more and more specialized came really kind of a shock to find this, had to identify this man as a biochemist. The hyphenated terms of science come in only with World War II, that recent. We gradually then began to have information of genetics, genes, and this biological species being controlled some kind of way. In the Darwinian time, it had cells. You recognize those cells or something. Learn a lot more about those cells looking with the microscope. Very extraordinary things go on here, and dichotomies of various kinds. So suddenly there are genes and something very specially controlling special designs of special creatures. So men begin to make it more and more, human beings begin to investigate more and more the control of those species. So what they needed was to get living organisms that had very rapid generations, to be able to see from generation to generation what the changes in my being, things like that, what any of the variables controlling my being. Found that fruit flies then had very swift regeneration. But even more so, and a lot was found through the fruit flies, but then found even more rapid were the tobacco mosaic viruses. Very rapid. That's where we gradually began to discover what was being responsible for various conditions in these growths. Then came the realization that you're dealing in viruses. And with it came this whole new area of virology. And virology got into the protein shells of the viruses, and within it discovering the DNA, RNA controls, the decode the guanine, thymine, cysteine, adenine, which came together to produce these extraordinary, unique designs of all the biological species. They were helical. They were helix. And studying the Watson, Crick, Wilkerson helix, you find that they made a complete helical cycle, came around once every ten increments. It came in increments of 36 degrees, each, and 10 times that, 360 degrees. This became extremely interesting. One thing I'll just point out to you, that the protein shells of all the viruses turned out to be all geodesic structures and all on the icosahedron, because the icosahedron uses the most volume with the least energy quantity to give you the greatest strength. So the virus shells are incredibly strong, they're all geodesics. And within the DNA, RNA, we find this helical. Now if you take tetrahedra and put fast tetrahedra face to face another tetrahedron. At this point, you can add another tetrahedron either on this face here or on that face. You have two choices. In fact, that's three. As you do, and you keep on adding it all the same way, you find it's a screw, makes a screw form, makes a helix. And this is the tetrahelix. And if you count your tetrahedrons go up every 10, you get a cycle. In fact, only tetrahedra, just in tetrahedra, bring about helix. So the very identity of the DNA, RNA helix comes immediately right back to our friend tetrahedron. Now we're getting down to some very, very intimate things, the basic building structure of the universe, et cetera, et cetera. Enough of that part. I just want to show you integration of information that's going on here. Three days, we're making many kinds of remote starts one from another, begin to find integration of information, getting down to very simple fundamentals. I want to come back to that concept of animate and inanimate. As we get to the area of virology, instead of there being virologists, there are physicists, the chemists, the biologists, the geneticists, they're all in there. It's a great potpourri of sciences. But everybody's so terribly excited with what they're finding that nobody's been, and there's a general propensity in the part of science having become more and more specialized not to philosophize about the significance of what they're finding and how it fits in other schemes. So we don't have the natural philosopher, as you would call, of the turn of the century, like the Principal of Bridgman or Whitehead and so forth. Bridgman is probably the last of the natural philosophers trying to see what is the philosophic consequence, what do you have to think about what it is you're finding over here in relation to other information. So we find then these virologists absolutely so intent and highly specialized, none of them have thought to say to society, your game of inanimate and animate is invalid. We find there's no such threshold existing between animate and inanimate. We simply have to say that we can call the phenomenon going on in here, you can call it biological if you want to, or you can call it absolutely, completely inanimate crystallography. They say, one thing we know now is that what is inanimate is getting clearer and clearer, and what's animate becomes less and less clear. In fact, we have to say we're being strict physicists in, as biologists, there isn't an animate because the atom is inanimate, and everything physical is atom. Either atom or the compound radiation, either radiation or atom. So what is inanimate, what was animate, so that gets clear, less and less clear. So that the physics center ran in through right through the chemistry and also our biology. So I think again we begin to have to think that that oversimplification of animate and animate as being all physical. Experiments have been made many times of young medical scientists in hospitals. A pauper, a man dying of cancer, knows he's dying, perfectly willing, because he likes the people in the hospital who don't know anything, he's perfectly willing to have his bed on a scale the time he's dying. And whenever death is, no weight is lost. At first, we start a little tiny bit of weight. It turned out to be the air in the lungs. The air in the lungs weighs quite a little. We take on 54 pounds of air a day, out of which we extract 7 pounds of oxygen to keep ourselves alive. And so the residual air, and there's actually no identifiable arrow moving, needle moving identification of anything being lost when the phenomenon of life goes. Now you often heard recently great specialists getting particularly into the chemistry, in the virology and so forth, getting to the point where they said they've been able to identify in stardust the unique chemistry is essential to produce the organism of life. Because they have now the key to life. When this man dies, all the chemistry right there. You know that. I now have to come to absolute conclusion that the mistake is all the time in identifying the inanimate as being the animate as being physical. What goes on in this room between you and I? And that word between is very important. Remember synergy. What goes on between you and I, which is understanding, is really not implicit in your organism, in your nose or your hair or anything. I simply say there's a synergetic phenomenon that does go on between that is not of. It is not the physical. And everything going on between myself and you is absolutely metaphysical. I use the word metaphysical. The physicist then identifies as physical is energy, energy associated as matter, and energy associated with radiation, one convertible to the other. Metaphysical is everything that doesn't move a needle. And there's nothing that moves any needles here regarding the information I'm giving you, the quality of the information, the significance of the information. That's absolutely metaphysical. And so I simply now then get to dealing with the metaphysical. Identify absolutely with life, because say the first single word that I can find to give me an experiential definition of something I call life is awareness. And this awareness is all that otherness, and it's a communication. And so I also came the other day giving you tetrahedron, triangles, so conceptual, that conceptuality independent of size. Conceptuality, and in order to have size, you had to have time. The clock had to go around. So I have conceptuality independent of size and time. This is pattern integrity, conceptuality independent, and this metaphysics goes on. Our understanding, we found those thoughts came then to dividing all total experience into all experiences irrelevant, outwardly and inwardly, getting down to accept that it's relevant. So our understandings, we found finding what are the connections between the stars that we do realize are relevant, lucidly relevant. What are the interconnections? Coming back again to these polyhedral structures. And pursuing this concept of pattern integrity, concept of knotting of energies where they can have interferences to bring about local apprehendability. And I'm introducing one other, it's a side input, and I'll come right back to where I am. Reality up to this century. Reality to humanity was everything you could see, smell, touch, and hear. And the newspapers are still operating on that basis. Reality is only what you see, smell, touch, and hear. The said the electron wasn't discovered until I was 3 years of age. The first wireless message of SOS around 12, very, very recent. During those years, we were finding ultraviolet and so forth. Suddenly, 1930 is the first publishing of taking an inventory of all the different forms of radiation and wave, electromagnetic waves and frequencies. So they found each, by this time, they found each chemical element had its unique electromagnetic frequencies given off. There were colors you and I couldn't see, but the emulsion, chemical emulsion could see. It had an interference. So we had then all the 92 regenerative chemical elements, because in 1932 we have the last isolation of the chemical elements. So we have suddenly publishing a chart of electromagnetic frequencies, and each of those metals having, apparently, they could be, they all have four separate, unique frequencies, not in serial order at all, different distances apart. If each one had a four-color hat band, and hat band, some are very wide, some very thin, but no hat band ever, in any way, is to be mistaken. There's no redundancy with any other chemical element. So iron, there'll be frequency here, and the great electromagnetic spread out here. There's another iron here, another, you find the four iron points in it. So we find the great electromagnetic spread, the great overlapping of the different chemical elements, enormous overlappings of these things, like a scenario universe of the overlappings. And where little human beings could see, going through great long waves and low frequencies, higher and higher frequencies, shorter and shorter waves, where human beings could see and hear this above infrared, is the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. And then you go on to ultraviolet, and then you go on to the higher frequency you can't tune in. When human beings have equipment to tune in, and you may be familiar with getting into if you have an automobile or a ship or an airplane, getting into your talking radio equipment, then you have unique bands that you can tune in on. And human beings have this tiny little band that you and I can tune in. And we find that is less than a millionth of reality. This is reality. These are the realities. And you and I can see less than a millionth of reality. For which reason, then, in going through any room we might be in, if you had could introduce a couple of million radio sets, a wide band, each one can be tuned in on a different. There are over 2 million programs in this room right now. If you have the right program turned on, the machine turned on. There is in here in this room, coming from the satellites, the sensor satellites going around Earth, is in this room a program which tells you where every beef cattle on our Earth is right now, how many there are. That's the new reality. You know, where all the wheat fields are in bloom. All that inventory can be taken just like that. That is a new reality, and we're not operating that way at all. So we're still operating that newspaper reality of the things you see, smell, touch, and hear. I wanted to really have that in here, so I began to get back then to thinking about the pattern integrity which I was developing and phenomena of life and so forth. I've introduced you knots, and I'm now going to point out to you that in my lifetime, very close to 80, a quite long time, when I was 70, I'd already processed over 1,000 tons of food, air, and water, which I brought temporarily together, which came with my hair and my skin, and got rubbed off and so forth. I've actually processed that many tons. I weighed into the scene of humanity at 7 pounds. I got to be 70 pounds, I got to be 170, I got up to 207. And I took off 70 pounds. I said, who's that? Because here I am. Obviously, that was not me. So what of that physical ever was me? I'd say none of it was ever me. I'm not just what I happened to have for breakfast last 7 years. I began to think about this quite differently. I'm going to getting down to human beings, identifying human beings in a non-Darwinian way. Darwin, as you all know, explaining his satisfaction of brains wanting beginnings and endings. Darwin explaining to humanity how it happened that we had human beings, and having the biologists having found their microscopes and so forth, all these various living organisms, we get down to the simplest one, we're getting down to amoeba, a single cell. And so he and the other biologists, he began to think, well, we put these cells together, and I said at that time he didn't really know anything about the genetics, he knew really nothing about the chemistry of these things. At the time of Darwin formulating his thoughts, Dalton was a great physicist, and at that time, Dalton was certainly only about half of the chemical elements had been isolated. We knew nothing about, and Dalton was assuming that all the chemical elements were built out of the hydrogen atom. So that monological desire, man, explained everything in the one thing, the building block of life, whatever it is. So Darwin then has a cell, a single cell creature, and he built all the other living creatures out of it. In these years, since the 1930 with electromagnetic spectrum identification of all those chemical elements, from 1932, the last of the 92 were isolated, a very new moment of history of man. And this is all phenomena of interest really only within this particular century. Man didn't know it was there before. We have, what I spoke to you about the other day, little human beings' ability to detect principles and employ those principles, getting refraction of light, which made possible to identify those frequencies of different chemical elements, but also ability to make lenses and so forth. And we have human beings and employing this equipment. They've been able, and I spoke about, we now have telescopic and photographic sweep out of about 11.5 billion light years radius of observation, where we've got these billion galaxies. We have all of that light coming from all around us for 11.5 billion years. All of it's been put through the spectroscope, photograph after photograph, been able to identify, human beings on our planet have been able to take inventory the relative abundance of all the chemical elements present in the thus far observed universe. And such phenomena begins to average out, in a sense. So you begin to find that is very interesting, because it seems to, if you get into isotopal, magic numbers of the isotopes, so forth, all part of this kind of a pattern. Now, if you want to identify various biological species by the chemical elements that are present, that's a very different way from just saying they grow out of a single cell. Because I said, at the time of the single cell, people were not thinking about the chemistry of the cell at all, for any importance. So I point out to you then that if I try to find the number of chemical elements in the amoeba, there are very few. Just as I find the sun has very few chemical elements. Most of the stars have relatively few. So this little amoeba has very few. If I want to find some counterpart of the relative abundance of the chemical elements in human beings, I find that the relative abundance of chemical elements in human beings, strangely enough, it seems to be congruent with the relative abundance of chemical elements in the universe. And it's only counterpart. Man, in this kind of term, seems to be miniature universe. Now I'll come to another very important point for you, which would say that we find universe is inherently complex. Unity is plural and a minimum two. And a great complementarity is difference, not mirror images. So we have an inherently complex universe. You don't start making explanations of one. You don't have to start. universe doesn't start or stop. It's eternal. So we have an eternal integrity being manifest here, and no stop and starting about it, and we find it inherently complex. There are pluralities in life principles that are not the same. They don't interfere. They're all intercommunicated. It's beautiful, extraordinary, fundamental, a priori, eternal complexity. When the word integrity comes out, because that's what's integrated altogether. I find then it's absolutely unnecessary to explain that human beings are built out of a building block. Therefore, also recognizing that what you and I are, I call nothing but a pattern integrities, very complex pattern integrities, similar to the complex pattern integrity of the universe with all this transforming continually going on. I'm now going to imagine with you, you've been through quite a lot, imagine I've made it literally. In fact, I don't think we have anything quite so important as our imagination. Where we take all this input information and begin to identify it with complex systems and be able to re-identify that species, whatever, it's been fantastic sorting of imagination. No man has ever seen outside himself. There's all this information from outside gets put together inside him in the studio, the television studio. It's our imagination studio. So, incidentally, this relates to the reality of our experience we're all going through here with this, with the video scope. I want to point out to you that I have lots of models around me. As I explored through the years, I used to make model after model to really find out how my principle was operating. There was a time when I went to Black Mountain College. I was there for 2 years. I was on the staff. I used to have a big trailer, and I had absolutely loaded with models. Gradually, I began to get better and better cameras and make beautiful photographs of my models. So then I had slides, and I would go around, always had my slide case, and I always had extra slides. Gradually, I began to find I needed not quite as many slides. Then suddenly, I'm meeting somebody very important. They said, I'm fascinated with what your slide show and all the things you said. Would you tell my friend over here, the president of Harvard University, what about that thing? And I don't have my slides with me. I found it perfectly possible for me to describe to the president of Harvard University in terms of, I must go back to his personal senses. I must find certain experiences he has had. I must be able to generalize them, get him to understand what he's talking about. In the end, he's going to see it in here anyway. Even if I had a slideshow, it's going to be operating in here. So I said, if I can build the imagination, my words, if I get him to do the building of the model, he'll remember it much longer than he does if he's seen on slide. I'm really quite confident that in running the show as we're running it, though it seems very attractive, the idea of my each time jumping up and finding the right model, I find that you're probably going to remember it very much better than if you've seen the actual model there. I'm seemingly digressing again, and I'm going to come back to this life phenomena and what I want you to imagine. I had a great friend, it was named Alex King. And Alex King, when I was a science and technology consultant on the Fortune staff, he was the art editor of Life magazine. And Alex King also was a good playwright, but he was quite an expert on the theater and drama, but many of the people who were writing plays would come to Alex King for counsel on how to handle their play. He saw many plays go to backers on Broadway and go through all the rehearsals and enormous amounts of money put up, and suddenly unfavorable criticism and dead. It is a very excruciating experience, that Broadway phenomenon. So Alex King wrote a beautiful play, and he decided he was going to get around all this. So what he did, he said, I'm not going to try and find a backer or anything. He took his own money and he hired, the pressure was still pretty much on, it was one of the good theaters in New York, he hired the theater for a night. And on that evening, he also then sent out invitations to all the critics of New York and many very distinguished people in New York to come to his opening. They came in full dress and everything. It was a very gay location. Alex found that he appeared on the stage and he said he found that in hiring the theater, he had also to hire the stagehands. So having hired and had to pay for the stagehands, he then had the stagehand get two grand pianos. So he had one at this end of the stage and the other. And from time to time, he would have his stagehand come in and switch the piano from one end to the other. So, and all he used them was to sit on. He'd get up, sit on the piano, and talk. And Alex then described on the stage the scene, the first scene of his play, and who the characters were. And he pointed his places, and the play opened, and he had this character, he's reading his play, and this character's saying this and that. And when that play was over, it was really a fascinating play. It was just before World War II. It went on in Vienna, and there's two young people who didn't want to get sucked into the war, and so they got themselves in, they played crazy and got put into a insane sound. But they played crazy. One was Romeo, the other was Juliet, so they still played Romeo and Juliet all through the war, and very well done. They planned in a Viennese cafe. Anyway, I saw people years and years after he got a rave report. The play never went out, and that's the end of it. But I've seen people, that's 1940, now 30 years ago, people saw, they can see every scene. I can see that cafe and know exactly the way it is. I can see it much more vividly than I've actually seen it then. So I'm really taking advantage of experience. I'm quite confident that I'm not really passing up a very important opportunity here in doing our video to be really always coming in with the right illustrations. Because I think that I've now forced myself to be very disciplined myself, be very careful to always go back to your experience, that you find you've had one of those kind of experiences. Together we find the principles operating there, and then we bring it into a special case use again of the principles. Now coming back then to Darwin and single cells and explanations of life, and discovering then that human beings have a number of chemical elements present that are not present in roses and oysters and so forth. And that I said, inasmuch as the universe is inherently complex, eternally and a priori, I see no reason at all why we shouldn't have a complex human right away. In other words, I was also finding you and I are not the chemistry which we use to make you and I visible in this particular biosphere as a particular sensing organism. That whatever's going on between you and I is absolutely not that materialism thing itself. I'm now going to go through, I said, all this open my talk about your imagination. We're now going to imagine going through a moving picture run backwards. You've seen that, where the people undive out of the water on the blackboard, get back on the springboard. I'm going to have you at breakfast, and we're running it backwards, and the food comes out of your mouth and back on the plates and so forth, and the dishes go back into the kitchen, and the things leave the dishes and go on the stove and back out of the stove into packages, and the water runs back in the faucet and all the, and gradually all these foods go back into the supermarket, and then from there backward into the country, and finally there's asparagus growing over here, and it's why pineapple comes from over there, so forth. And then they come apart, the plants come apart, and they go back into rain in the sky and the other chemistry, so that something goes back as sunlight. And we find then, in no time at all, you have come apart, and your part of you today, 2 months ago, was over the Himalayan mountains as air. So I see then all these constituents gradually coming together until they find together in the closest association. And all they do is get tied up in a number of knots, a whole lot of slip knots. So you and I are a pattern of integrity sliding along on all these strands that came from all around the universe, coming gradually, momentarily together, and then they all come apart again and leave us. And they go out of that 1,000 tons of that process and become part of other organisms and so forth, part of the scenery, and joining up with other trees, whatever it may be. So I see that I was never was anything but a beautiful design, pattern, integrity, and that I've been employing this equipment for my information sensing under the particular biological condition of this particular planet. You never have to think about other human beings and other planets unless you had exactly the same biological condition, same biosphere, and I would doubt if that doesn't seem even mildly necessary, because there's a designing capability to have a sensing organism of any kind on any one of these areas. And much of it would be invisible to our eyes today, because we just have a very limited reporting business. I'm then going to point out to you that you probably have had this experience, because I've had it several times, but a very good friend of mine said, I want you to meet my friend Joe. You just really love each other. You're just the same kind of people. And they say it a number of times, you meet from year to year, and I got to get you and Joe together. And I to pick up the telephone to call up Joe, and your friend introduces you to Joe. And you talk to each other on the telephone. A very nice personality, really like Joe very much. Then it happens that Joe and you are in the same kind of activity, and you find yourself at one university or the other one and so forth. You have this very responsibility. Then you call up Joe because you need some information that Joe might have at his university. Sure enough, he has it. Anyway, you find yourself as life goes on calling one another more and more, find the other one extremely agreeable about it, like him very much, and they have just the kind of information. You're both interested in the same thing, so life goes on, and many of your friends are dying off. Joe is the only friend you got left, but you've never seen Joe. You don't want anybody getting in the way and bother your great friend Joe, so you have a special red telephone, that's Joe. Other people call you another telephone. So all you know, Joe is a red telephone. And all of us are really beautiful, self-resurfacing, self-rebuilding telephones, walking information processing phenomena, and people get mixed up with the telephone, calling me Bucky, telephone. Now I now get to seeing that as much as we are just pattern integrities, and pattern integrities are conceptual. They can be very high frequency, but we have all kinds of high frequency phenomena. Therefore, I see no reason why I couldn't send you from here to there in the universe by radio, by simply scanning your frequencies. I see no reason why, if we're the game universe, with all the permitted moves of all the frequencies that can be employed, all the intertransformabilities, I would say it'd be really kind of interesting to follow through on the game universe and see how it might come out. So each one of us could be the same universe, but playing the game this particular kind of way with all those degrees of freedom. I mentioned that to you just in passing the other day. I said the words, but I hadn't identified how I got there. Furthermore, then, I see absolutely exactly the opposite from the Darwinian way of trying to build us up out of building blocks and locally. I see that we're part of just that integrity of the universe that really needs us here as that local monitor, information gathering, problem-solving capability. We've been some time running now, and so we've stopped for 10 minutes after 8. We start again at 20 after 8. I used the word annihilation 2 days ago, and I gave an example of the kind of annihilation that the physicist speaks about when he uses the word, where I gave you the rubber glove, that only one rubber glove on your left hand, you stripped it off, and now the left hand had disappeared, there was only a right hand. I'd like to give you another confirmation of the annihilation. And the kind of confirmation I'd like to give you relates then to the kind of confirmation I'd like to give on generalized principles themselves. I've talked to you about brain always dealing only in special cases, and that the mind finds a generalized relationship that exists between but is not ours, that is absolutely eternally existent. And in those generalized principles, in contradistinction to the special case experiences, we have then, for instance, man discovering the principle of the lever. And having discovered the principle of the lever, finds then the distance from the fulcrum to the load, use that as a basic increment, and he goes out one increment here, gets even balance, he gets two increments, he gets 2-to-1 advantage, and goes out 10 increments, goes 10-to-1 advantage. So you might say, now have the arithmetic, the actual mathematical formula for leverage. And that mathematical formula for leverage then makes it possible. I say, I ought to be able to design a generalized lever. If you find your cat, it's going to have to be wood, or it's going to have to be steel. It has to be such and such a length. You find that even though human mind has the ability to discover generalization out of all the special cases which we subjectively experience, and mind gets that generalized principle, if it wants to employ the generalized principle, it has to go back into the terminality of time and have a special case again. So both subjectively and objectively, we have to live in the special case, though our mind can go in this eternal generalization. And I also then pointed out that the generalization of leverage could then be demonstrated as Galileo showed. Leverage could then be demonstrated not as a bar at all, or something you call that kind of lever, but the principle of the mathematics of leverage also would then held true with pulleys. So you have a set of pulley blocks, and every time you have a rope going through around making a circuit here, we have another one of those leverage advantages, exactly the same law. And the same laws then get into all the gears, all machinery, all the translation of different sizes and different velocity and everything. It's all just levers, series of levers around a common hub. And so I wonder if it was simply a series of those levers around a common hub. And so I find this principle of leverage manifesting itself all kinds of different shapes, as well as all special sizes, but you can't have it generalized anything physically and realized in our life. Now, in the same way, then, coming back to annihilation, I want to give you a different type of example from the rubber glove. And a very good one is that I'll just take the octahedron. You may remember then that I had an octahedron complementing tetrahedra. If I take this tetrahedron and another tetrahedron, put it on the table, I like to then fill all space. I can get those three tetrahedra together, but they found that the fourth one could not fit in there with a space between it and room for another tetrahedron. So I got frustrated. But I could balance this tetrahedron on top of the other ones here. And this would give me the big tetrahedron. But the space inside between them here is no longer a tetrahedron. It is an octahedron. Let me just put this then in the way you can see it exactly what it is. There's this face, and so forth, the bottom face, and so forth, the top of the octahedron, back of it there. So octahedra complement tetrahedra. And you may remember then, I now have a tetrahedron twice the size of the little tetrahedron. And when we double the symmetrically the size of an object, then we get each of the areas is 2 to the 2nd power, 4. I see one triangle goes to 4 triangles on the surface there. And the volume goes 2 to the 3rd power, or 8. So this big tetrahedron is 8 times the volume of this little tetrahedron. And you see the big tetrahedron, there are 4 little tetrahedra on each corner. So if I take 4 from 8, I leave 4. So the octahedron, which is left inside here, has a volume of 4. If I take away, the total thing is 8, I take away 1, take away 2, take 3, sloth and ape, and that leaves me sloth, the tetrahedron of volume of thought. I gave you the other day a way of showing that the octahedron is consisting of four asymmetric tetrahedra around a common axis, and each one of those had the same altitude and the same base as the regular tetrahedron, so they had the same volume. Now, having then recalled that a tetrahedron, when a tetrahedron's volume is four, is one, an octahedron is four, I'm going to take this octahedron, I'm going to do something with it that is really quite fascinating to experience. It has 12 vectors. Remember, four around, four around, four around this way. I'm going to take any one of those vectors. I'll take this one right here in front of me. I'm going to take it out, disconnect it from these vertexes. I'm going to put it right back in again, instead of having between these two vertexes, I'm going to put it between these two vertexes. So the same vectors, and it now makes one tetrahedron, two tetrahedron, three tetrahedron. In fact, this is the beginning of the tetrahelix. And we go on then from volume of four to volume of three, absolutely neatly. We've annihilated one. Same vector, same all the energy, all the energy count, actually you've definitely given up one. And this is exactly where you go from the generalized octahedron into the special case tetrahedron. I love the tetrahelix, which is the way you get in your DNA and RNA, your regular special case life. That's any form. Let's prove that you can come back and I regain one again. Here we are at octahedron again. Now, I want to go back to something else I talked about the other day. Specialization. I would like to expand on specialization. As I said to you the other day, I'm introducing sort of very major topics, major ways of looking at the universe, and then coming down into special considerations within the specialization of humanity on board of our planet. And speaking about then the lack of awareness of the phenomena, behaviors of holes in particular parts, which is denoted uniquely by the word synergy, and the majority of 97% of the university students were unaware of the word synergy or the phenomena itself, and the same 1% of the general public. So I can understand how a general public could really be in a very easy position to be deceived by a general big pattern where you say you ought to be all specialists and so forth, and not realizing the advantage that could accrue. I can understand how just a little man born in poverty and so forth, wanting to have his family have something going on, looking out for himself, not realizing then that this is anti-synergetic rather than the best way to carry on, that it is entropic. I find then that thinking about the specialization, one of the things I have observed in my experience, and you must also experience to some extent, but I said already between you and I at your age level, what is your average age level? I guess that you were, I would say 20, 19, 20, somewhere in the 20. So 20, and I'm 80, so I'm four times your age, so I've had four times the pattern experience. So the information coming in so fast that you're 20 may be equal to, say, 60 man, but I've got a little more of experience than you and a little longer time to observe a lot of these pattern changes that are occurring. And I'm introducing an introduction. I'm coming back to my specialization. I've just been very recently writing. In fact, I was writing on today. Ed Applewhite, who's with us, has worked with me in production of my book, Synergetics. We've been working all these years, and we're getting ready pages for a second edition. And thinking about syntropy and entropy and synergy and energy behaviors, it became really very interesting to realize that the obviously, with all the different periodicities in which things occur in our universe, that when energies are given off by a system, as I said earlier today, and the energy is given off by the system, then altering the environment, that the energy is being given off by little local systems seem to be disorderly and random. But it's because the frequency, the periodic periods have not repeated themselves enough for you to discover order. Now, I want you to think about experience you have heard. You've heard engines of twin-engine boat or twin-engine airplane where the engines are not what they call synchronized, where they're not running exactly the same speed. When they're not synchronized, you hear something goes, wow, 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 wow. There is a periodicity of wowing. And it might be quite far apart, and might be quite close together, like wow, 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 wow. And these are then how often they do get actually for the moment and say he's going to go out again. So that periodicity is orderly. There's so many rounds before you get to where the gears mesh. Only every so often, the gears are quite different. Once in a while, they sink in. So I see then that there are a great many wows that occur at greater periods of time. For instance, the Halley's Comet coming around 70 years. And we have other phenomena must come around in 178, and then fast up to just very recently, men knew of novae when stars explode, and they had one that's observed historically, and so they curve from time to time. That's about all you could say. You can know predicting when the next novae would occur. No sets of periodicities that we know about. If it didn't know any periodicity, then it seems disorderly. The randomness is that you have not been around long enough, you don't have enough time span to judge, to realize that there are periodicities, there is orderliness there after all. That's all I'm trying to get at. This became very interesting, really, thinking in the terms of lifetimes and frequencies, and now there are accelerations and information coming into it. But at any rate, it became very clear that myopically, you would think it would tend to look very disorderly. I find then people who do not look at enough information tend then to feel quite dismayed. And we find our particular society today in great dismay over what seems to be getting increasingly disorderly. It seems to be more and more out of control. And so it's very easy for writers to be very negative. I find then the same people then are very eager for the next news. And they keep getting more and more news, and the higher the frequency of the news, they're looking more and more myopic just tonight. So from that view, the more you just localize on the news, the more you concentrate on it, the more disorderly things are going to seem. In fact, the newspapers find that people then are really only looking for disorder, and they find that only bad news is saleable. There's been survey after survey of the publishers. They find good news is just not saleable. And they have to sell their papers or be able to get advertising, because their own money is made through the advertising. So they have to find what is saleable, and bad news seems to be saleable. I just want to point out that it would be then very, very desirable to people who are specialized and separated from one another and tending not to see enough of anything to tend to be discouraged. And the way in which I've been able to present order to you is by looking from very, very large spans. You only get that order, so you get to get the larger the span of time, the larger the span of experience you look at, the more opportunity you have to see the order. It became very exciting to me thinking in these matters, and when Einstein took great note of the fact that there was apparently a top speed of radiation, not just of light, first a measure of light, but then found other radiations all have apparently the same speed in vacuo, absolutely nothing to oppose them. Energy linearly was traveling this 186,000 miles a second, it's radiation. So he came then to a conclusion that the universe really does have a limit on the velocity side. Einstein was thinking in contradistinction. I said to Newton, who was thinking at rest, and to Newton, at rest was the norm, and Einstein said, the norm is 186,000 miles a second. That is a top, and then any other thing we can, by interference in how it ties itself up and not, how this could be able to develop this equation, the amount of energy in its mass related then to that speed of radiation, not a second power. Why? Because radiation was omnidirectional and not linear. So it had to be the second power, which is the surface rate of growth of the linear. It's a very beautiful equation, you see there, and really very comprehensible. And when you take his argument that norm would be then unleashed energy, absolutely nothing block it, unless you have to understand explain it by the numbers of interferences and blockages, the self blockages of an inherently complex universe. Plurality is unity is plural, and therefore something that interferes with itself. We find then I became very excited to discover that as various, we're going back to the importing-exporting idea I gave you of the energies being given off, the stars are all entropic and giving off the radiations. All entropic systems then gradually expanding and becoming more and more disintegrated, the parts come further and further apart, less and less critical proximity one to the other. I said, and they decided, they're not thinking about this kind of annihilation where I can annihilate one and then put it back in again at another point. I simply, a preset. What did I do with that one little member? I turned it, I precessed it 90 degrees. That's all. The one little precession, the effect of energy on this, make this precess disappear. The one disappear. Now, understand then the energies then coming to terminal ends in the time sense where there's a maximum disintegration, but there are other systems that are disintegrating. This means then that the disintegration from this one, this way, and from other ones gradually began to get into some concentrations with one another. And you get where there's reconcentrating, and suddenly you get where your proximity to the disintegration star from this other one, you're nearer to that one than you were to your own disintegrating star of yesterday. But suddenly, this is then the birth of the new. This is the centropic, where again the critical proximity begin to come together again. So I saw that there was really a beautiful moment of maximum dispersal and maximum disorder, which probably would light because of the radiation to the radiation maximum. Therefore, there would be also a maximum disorder. That there'd be a top of disorder, and that top of disorder is when you're most disintegrated, but that's the point, the other one is taking over, the new groups are forming. It would be quite exciting to realize that is also terminal. And it's absolutely, I'm sure it's exactly proportional to the speed of the light. We have then, this is what began to tell me then, they got to the point where this second grouping, this is periodic, so there's suddenly a new birth. So in that kind of wow, you'd have to wait for 10 billion years and nobody's around. Remember that sort of wow, and wait 10 billion years, wow. This is when you discover there is really no disorder all the time. Finally came together. That's the last two to get together. This I find it very, very, very satisfying in realization of an eternally regenerative universe where you see this one phases out and then appears there. The foremost one went out, then it reappears there. See how that goes on. You see also how then the special case DNA, RNA is always one less than the real eternity. So you see how you phase out, because this is the three phase, and this is the four phase. This is a generalized case, that's a special case. So that the general is always one up on the general, on the special, so if there's something that seems to come apart, the other one is waiting over here to join it again. Now, just in relation to my talking that way, you couldn't help but be interested of my own experience. Three years ago, we were doing a world game to Ketchi and Boston University. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. And there, sitting in the front row, I spoke three times that day in Boston, different parts, and I saw this man always sitting there in front. He turned out to be a Russian physicist who was visiting at Harvard. And he and another Russian physicist and an MIT physics professor, and a Harvard professor, came out to ask if they could come and see me that weekend. And they'd been having a very important kind of a physicist conference there at Cambridge, and they said that they'd found my one on, one off, they've been able to really substantiate this physically, that they were really confirming my explanation of annihilation theorem. Now, there are a number of ways that it shows up. These things begin to show up in many, many ways. Now, the next thing we'll go on back to my specialization. That's a very big digression from specialization. Every little child demonstrates to us, as born, their interest in the whole universe. It's really one of the most beautiful things about a child is its interest in the macrocosm and the microcosm. And there are no enthusiasts for the planetarium quite like the children. They love this thinking in the big way. And they ask the parents most beautiful questions about the relatedness and the bigness. They're looking for these generalized explanations. And the parents are so deeply specialized and so engaged in their special life, they're not able to really give this kid the generalized kind of explanation the child really would like to have. So we find human beings are born and demonstrating a proclivity to be generalists, to deal in total information. Because if you're a specialist, you're not going to have enough any opportunity to get at the generalization, the more they specialize you. So we say, how did it happen that humanity became specialized? And I find, as I came into the game of life, where I was told you the other day, earning a living was much more, seemingly absolute imperative when I was young. It was not considered to be in your day, so that's a very great change in its own right. But at that same time, I found it was assumed that specialization is highly desirable, in fact, inexorable, inevitable, and a great advantage, because if you get to be a specialist, then you're going to have your own little toll gate that society's going to have to go through, and your living is probably insured. So it's been really very easy to promote that specialization. I began to wonder, how did it happen that a society, having been born with a propensity to be a comprehensivist, it ends up by being a specialist and having the working conviction this is what you're supposed to do, and the very best advantage to be gained from it? So I thought and pondered and explored this idea a very great deal. Alfred North Whitehead, a very great natural philosopher, came to Harvard from the European University, England, and he came there early in the century, and he noted at Harvard University, which was then relatively small, as all universities were, he noted that at Harvard they were instituting an entirely new educational concept. They were developing special graduate schools. At the European University, you could become an expert in a subject living within the general colleges and finding out where the professor who was best informed on that particular subject, you look him up, or you can find the authority in your library. You as an individual went venturing into different places where the expertise existed, but you didn't have to have a special university, a special campus living. But Harvard is the first to actually institute special campus, special buildings, special staff, faculty for this graduate school. And Whitehead noted that Harvard, having done that, there was great popular applause of the idea in America. And maybe the popular applause came because the people who were instituting it may have owned the newspapers, but anyway, there was popular applause, and it was rationalized that America loved all-star teams. and they want, by having the very best first baseman, the very best pitcher and so on, they can keep winning games. So this seems like specialization is going to make American economy one where you had all stars out here, and we'd have a very, very prosperous economy. The idea was so popularized, although immediately other of the private universities began to copy. And then gradually it became such a demonstration that the people who had monetary advantage seemed to be educated, and so therefore the man who wanted to get elected and found his constituency could get the high school, he got him a school, and then he's going to get them the college, and then he's going to get them a graduate school. So the graduate school idea proliferated very, very rapidly. Whitehead writes about this and writes about it very well, and they said then at the universities, and where they then deliberately sifted out the seeming brights from the dulls by examinations. And they deliberately undertook to persuade the brights to go on into the graduate school. And not all of them did go, but the call who did get there were the ones who then were sifted out as apparently bright. So these brights in the graduate school then found themselves in a very much more specialized field than ever before. Each one has to be a specialist within a special field. So it began to, all the energy of that individual became more and more linear. Instead of being a wide angle, it's getting a very narrow angle, and it's just been very powerful acceleration. So you take a candle flame that is sending radiation all four directions, put a reflector behind it, and you very greatly concentrate. Put it, you lens it down to very fine and get an enormous amount of energy, so that a little candle flame has been able to serve in a lighthouse where you couldn't see the candle by itself more than the quarter of a mile, half a mile or something like that, and suddenly you're seeing it several miles as like you can concentrate with the beaming. So we found all these individuals at the graduate schools began to be found linear acceleration. Each one finds himself way out in this particular subject. And each one finding himself way out in this particular subject would realize that nobody could come into his place and say, I see what you're doing. You've already gone beyond that obvious kind of phase. So he would not think of going into the other man's laboratory and say, I see what you're doing. So Whitehead pointed out that while then society called out all the brights and made them all specialists, the specialists couldn't put things together. When they came to meet with one another, began to talk about baseball, because they realized their own experience, they lack of technology to try to talk about the other man especially. So, inasmuch as the specialists couldn't put things together on behalf of society, the wealth was not being realized. It should be so. As Whitehead then pointed out, having selected the brights from the dolls, you had to leave it to the dolls to put things together. And this begins what I call Whitehead's dilemma. And we find then that the fairly brights, but not bright enough to go on, went on to be their pretty good football players too, so they got to be president, vice president, the heads of big corporations. And they were too attractive and pretty good playboys, so they didn't get in that specialist stuff. So as heads of the corporations, they would then hire specialists from the university, because they remember about their friend who was a specialist. And so they had him in for special tasks. And as the head of the corporation, they say, I can't possibly, we make automobiles, but and we agree that automobiles will not run over the open fields, so we're going to have highways, but we can't afford the automobile company to build all those highways. So what we do is make our automobiles very, very attractive on racetracks and automobile shows, and have the people demand the automobile. Then the really quite dull politicians will realize they can get elected by satisfying people's longing to get one of those automobiles start rolling, so the politicians will build all the roads. So we find that the lower the order of brightness, the larger the responsibility. When you get to international affairs, you can see where we are today. May wear striped pants very beautifully, may wear charming, but they do not really tend to see things in this comprehensive way. Now, I simply then come to further examination how it happened we get to be specialists. And this brings me to several very important large-scale thinkings again about human beings on board of our planet. In order to design, as we apparently deliberately were designed, naked, absolutely helpless for months and absolutely ignorant, so that we would be then able to discover ourselves and to get to our own artifacts of putting something on because you're cold or whatever it may be. We find then the individuals all being born naked and helpless, they obviously would not be, and we're more than such a large amount of water that would freeze, we certainly couldn't be born clothesless, naked, in, up in the Arctic. So I began to say, where would this naked life probably have to be? And certainly lying there as a good mouthful for a lion, for months you can't even move yourself, so it'd be good play for the lions, and the lion can knock down the parents very easily. So this would be pretty good lion eating. So you have to be someplace where there aren't lions. You couldn't be where you're going to freeze to death, and it could be lions. So when I got down to the, where are the most propitious parts on our globe for life to be born naked and helpless? I came then quite clearly the coral atolls of the South Pacific. Unquestionably, the Great Barrier Reefs then break those enormous waves. And inside the lovely lagoons are full of fish, all kinds of eatables, and the very easily shoaling lovely sands, and you climb out in and out of that as a baby factory. And on the shore, cocoa's falling down full of milk and all kinds of things to eat. Then no big animals to eat you. So I came to the conclusion, life being born naked, helpless, probably in Kara, then began to have experience after experience with that water, because logs fell into the water. They found the log floated and the stone sunk. So they learned then if you want to stay on top of the water, you can get on top of some logs. They begin then to try out rafts, and they can go out and get more of the fish out in the lagoon with the raft. Then they find the raft blows around in the lagoon. And so some of the branches of the logs still there, leaves, blows a little faster. And they found that the logs, when the wind is blowing around them, one log would roll over, so you get two logs where the branch fell over here and left, and lash it to it, and won't roll anymore. So that's much more comfortable, non-rolling logs than rolling logs. You get at least two of them, and you're out on your raft, with your logs bound together, fishing down in between here, and you find when the wind is blowing, the logs do not just go to leeward, call it going downwind. Not at all. Just look at a log, and on the side this way, there's an enormous amount of frontal area. But turn it this way, there's a very small frontal area. So when the wind is blowing on it, it goes in the direction of least resistance. So it'll go this way. Maybe a little downwind, but it has leaves up on the branches still on the log, the raft. That makes it a more windy, since the wind blowing on it begins to go in the direction of the logs and not downwind. Gradually, men began to discover with those logs that they could put down another fairly thin piece of log down the water, and they could make it then literally when the wind is blowing, it began to go a little bit to windward. We find then that in the wind sailing beginning, as far as the artifacts go in history today, it's very probable that the beginnings of navigation, where they went offshore completely, no landmarks to go by whatsoever, where they began to deal, and we now know very beautifully the design of their guys, the sticks, crossing sticks. They went from the rising of this star to the setting of that star. They went between. So there are two stars and themselves. This is the beginning of trigonometry, I'm sure. Anyway, to me then, these people in the water learning they could even sail the wind and not have to go drift with the winds or drift with the tides. Then the man be really self-determining which direction you want to go. You actually deliberately go to wind. You can't go straight to wind. You have to beat to wind. They learned to do that very beautifully. These are lovely craft, these proas, and they still make 20 knots. Apparently, they've probably been this way for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. I think that man began on the coral atolls, and he began absolutely naked. And being naked, the skin exposed, you get pigmentation. He's going to get brown, going to get tanned very deeply, and you get finally inbreeding where those particular kind of genes will begin to possibly stay there with characteristics. So we find that Polynesian, pretty dark-skinned Polynesian. Then when these people began to be able to sail to the west and they come to the southeast coast of Asia, to the Thai area and so forth, coming into the islands, getting bigger and bigger islands and suddenly on the mainland, came to the mainland, I'm sure for thousands of years, the patent indicates since we first come to it, that they then moored their raft or their sailing craft just offshore, so you could reach on the land in the daytime, but you didn't want to go there in the nighttime when all those animals were roaming. But in the daytime, you could handle things, so gradually they keep going on the land in the daytime, and began to gradually domesticate and tame elephants and sheep and all kinds of animals that were much bigger than themselves. And with those sheep and goats and so forth, it's pretty easy to skin them. They began to follow their goats and their sheep, and the grasses grew better and better up. They were mildly seasonal going up the hills of the monsoon, where when the green grasses went up, they went up the mountains with their sheep. And it got very cold at night. And they were eating their sheep, and they had the skins of the sheep to put on themselves, so they weren't getting cold anymore. And they learned how to, again, taking this kind of spars and rigging they'd done the boat to take a number of they're going along. The sheep were carrying their own skins, and they came to a place where they just take several trees and bend them towards each other, make a tripod of more trees still, and cover them with the skins of the sheep. So they had the skin on their body and directly in the secondary skin of their yurt, their hut. We find these people able to get into colder and colder climate, and tribe after tribe following the sheep gets broken up, where some of the sheep went this way and some went that way, so some of the members of the tribe went off with these, and they never got together again. Going off from the Southeast Asia, tending to follow this man did, the sun, identifying the sun very powerfully with the metabolic processes. They don't know the word metabolic, they don't understand photosynthesis, but their point is that they recognize there's something to do with that sun. That sun's been going that way. There's a proclivity landing down in Southeast Asia to work toward Northwest. And so we have human beings working western, and it's an incredibly large continent and all kinds of incredible mountains and deserts and so forth, getting separated one from the other. And as they separated one from the other, we have the chieftain then has a procreative urge, and the only one around female around is his own granddaughter. So there's enormous inbreeding of the surviving types. And we have then Darwin's type of survival, where he discovered, for instance, that the wild horses, there's every once in a while a stallion is born bigger than the other young stallions. Didn't have to be bigger, but that big stallion then suddenly finds itself being attacked in a battle by the king stallion. There's a big stallion of the herd, the biggest it was. And he has a battle with a new young big stallion, and whichever one wins is the one who's going to inseminate the herd. And that was where Darwin saw the strongest strains being concentrated. He didn't have the word genetics at that time, but he saw the strain, they used the word strain, would then be highly concentrated. So we have in the same way these tribes breaking up, working westward over those incredible lands, just working, not fast at all, just going along local circulating rounds with their sheep and their goats and so forth, their wild horses, and gradually getting terribly separated out. And the type that do survive under special, these are very special conditions. You go up the mountainside, different kinds of weathers and get. You go in the desert area. As the types who survive best as a chieftain in that area, marrying the girl who survives best in that kind of area. So they get to be highly concentrating. When we do this inbreeding, what you do is breed out general adaptability and breed in special capability for the special set of conditions. So for that particular kind of environment, they turn out to be the most liable to survive. So we have, by the time these people are really reaching way to the west of Russia and dealing with the most northwesterly of that total continental area, had 148 nations to deal with, the word nation being then tribes that have been isolated one from the other for such long periods, thousands of years, as to begin to inbreed special facial characteristics. Where they literally look differently, they sound differently, they smell differently, they get by inbreeding the special conditions. So Russia had 148 nations to integrate when she tried to put together the Soviets. So very extraordinary kind of a challenge. What we call a nation, the United States is not even mildly a nation. There were some Indian nations that were here. There's some Indian nations still there. They were highly inbred in the same way of the wandering. But we have, America is cross-breeding world man, anything but a nation. Very important to make these distinctions as you consider all our problems today and ways of solving problems and so forth, and the things that are being said by people carelessly, just parroting and so forth. I'm coming back then to these people moving northwesterly and getting more and more covered up with the cold, because it's so cold up in those mountains. And they had to go through an incredible number of mountain passes, very cold, and they had to hibernate. Had to stay in the caves during this very bad wintry time, the snows. So we have people getting more and more covered up, and therefore beginning gradually bleaching out a little more. And so the characteristics of those who are tending to bleach out, then they begin to get concentrated in the genetics. By the time we get completely far northwest, it comes to very white skin, very, very blonde hair. I'm certainly now also pointing out, too, that the people coming from those islands also went not all up to the northwest. Some of them went sailing to windward across the, using the monsoon and the different winds across the Indian Ocean. But part of the year, you're really blown over to Africa, and another part of the year, blown back to India and the Strait settlements and so forth. So the number of them crossed to very hot areas. As they got in very hot and relatively arid, getting equatorially, they tended to get blacker and blacker. There was a concentration to do that. They hit the East Africa and they moved enormous, get finally going across the just south of that Sahara form, and you get into great bulge of where Nigeria has 25% of all the Africans. Where there's a pooling, had gone all the way west and pooling backwardly. And the flow of them went that way and then down southeast, and finally got to be the Zulus and the Swazi and so forth going into South Africa. We have the blacks then representing another pigmentation of the best kind of skin to be under, really the equatorial sun, and a kind of, I've been a visiting professor at all the universities across that equatorial Africa. And when you get in northern Nigeria, we get up to Kano and so forth, but you're getting what's called the Harmattan, and really there's these enormous dust storms coming off the Sahara, and the whole sky is just full of it. And you find your nose and your mouth really drying out, and your lips tending to come out like this. The very characteristics of the African begin to be really just, you feel it in your own features. So I simply say to you, very simply to me, The original skinned man is a dark skinned man, and the white is very Johnny come lately, and the very very dark ones is another. They go on like the white from the more or less Polynesian darkness, and I often find myself with very large numbers. I've been in Africa a great deal, but in Africa, as I say, let's all turn our hands to the roof. And where the sun couldn't get it, it is the same pink. So take off your shoe and look at that. The sun goes pink. I say, there's absolutely no such thing as race. Let's cut out the nonsense. You've got enormous inbreeding of special genetic families. We've got enormous temporarily, but now that's all going over and we're cross-breeding back again. Now, in the same terms, then, I'm talking about my specialization. I gave you the chieftain. I spoke about the big stallion. I'm sure that early human beings, born naked, helpless, and so forth, every once in a while, a big male is born. He didn't ask to be bigger, but he is bigger. And we take the total surface of our Earth, which is three-quarters of it covers the water, and so 25% is covered with land. A very great deal was rock and deserts, mountains, and so forth, untenable. And of places where the conditions were such that vegetation grew and would immediately support life, so probably not much more than 10% of total of the planet is really producing foods, and those early days maybe down to 1% where things are immediately favorable to support your life. And that 1% is broken up in tiny little packages all over the place. So that the people who are lucky for the moment suddenly find something going wrong. There is a fire, there's a drought, and particularly as you get on that mainland, getting away from the the biggest sea picture, where there were fish and everything, so again, that dry land, we find then the once in a while, then there's this big guy born, and they're in a place where they're just living on bananas, and so the little man said, I can't reach the banana, Mr. Big Man, you reach me on the big banana. So I reach the big man reaches the banana. Then, very, very similarly, the people find themselves being invaded by people who run out of bananas, and they've had droughts and fires and so forth, and these people are absolutely critically hungry, and they're going to fight for their lives. And they find themselves being invaded, so they say, Mr. Big Man, you got to get out there in front to protect us from these little, we can't do so much, you big fella, get out there. So the big man didn't ask for it, but he didn't ask to be big, but he suddenly finds himself being inducted in, particularly in this fighting business. Sorry, I think I got into this with you a little the other day, and I said that this same big man having been brought into the fighting needed then to command things during, between fights. He found the fights occurred fairly often, so he could get prepared for the fight. He said, you've got to get a lot of food together for me, for my fighters to be really pretty hungry characters, and we also need some spears at that time to make weapons to prepare for that enemy. You see, we had these kind of weapons, we'd fool them. So that we have the big man begins to find himself commanding things in peace times as well as wartime. So he also then, actually the big man, he's the biggest there is around, and he finds that he because he's commanding everything, other big men are born, and they say, this guy's got it pretty good, he's king, I think I can lick him. So the king finds himself being challenged time again by a big guy, and he finds he can lick them all, but intuitively, without having any kind of education, he just fundamentally said, don't let two of those big guys come at me at once. But this way, this beginning of grand strategy, the power structure, divide and conquer. And to keep conquered, keep divided. So nothing can be more fundamental and important to power structure. So we find then the big man saying, I need you other big men when the war comes, so I don't want to annihilate you, but I want to make you keep apart from one another during this peace time. And I want to get you coming together, me, and bring all. I want you to train a lot of soldiers over your place and come together. And we'd go hunting once in a while to kind of have a little conference about things here, keep track of you. So we have the big man commanding things and being annoyed from time to time by a lot of little people who disobey his orders, not the big man. And he gets so bothered by the fact they're stealing things from him, they're breaking his orders, he cannot be able to get things ready for the war. And so, you got to bring in this character. So tell the big man, bring in this little character and get the little character. So you really are a troublemaker, and the only thing to do is cut your head off. And the little man says to the king, Mr. King, you made a great mistake cutting my head off. And the king said, you're impertinent also. why should I not cut your head off? So Mr. King, I happen to understand the language of your enemy over the hill, and you don't. And I've heard what he says he's going to do to you, and you don't know about that. Well, young man, you got a pretty good idea there. You report to me every day about what my enemy over the hill is saying, and your head's going to stay on. Then you're going to do something you never did ever before. You're going to eat regularly. How do you like that? Come eat right at my table, or out here at the castle. So you agree to do that, and so these people have been making trouble for him. He brings them in, and one by one they tell him about special things they can do. And this man can make a better sword than anybody else, and he has, and understands metallurgy, so he has to prove it. And King makes it prove it. He makes it, no question, a beautiful sword. So he said, you just make swords, keep on that metallurgy. And somebody else is stealing from him, and they said, Mr. King, the reason I steal from you is I understand arithmetic and you don't. And if I use my arithmetic, I could keep other people from stealing from you. So he keeps him on, too. So now he has what he did then. It makes each one of these people specialists. But he said, that you mind your business. You understand that? You mind your business. You mind. I'm the only one who minds everybody's business. I could clear everybody. So he is in, without knowing about synergy, he becomes the one who's in the position to have the integrated information. And he has a synergistic advantage, which multiplies them really very rapidly. The other people are in a disintegrated position. So they don't get the synergetics that he gets. Now, we find he gets so powerful with all his specialists, he has the right logistics, and he has the right information, and he has the right tools and everything. So he becomes king of a very large realm. And there's all these different other specialists all working for him. You know, somebody making, taking care of breeding his horses, or somebody else making special harness for the horses, wherever it may be. And we have him now getting old, and he wants his son to take over. And he said, I see you're getting pretty old, Mr. Linguist, and you're getting very old, Mr. Mathematician, so on. So I want you to teach somebody about that language. You want to teach somebody about the metallurgy. You want to teach something about the mathematics, what it is. And this is actually the foundation of our educational system. This is simply, it was a grand strategy of the power structure to keep divided, and what he did then was to make all the intellectuals, all the people who are bright but not big physically, use the metaphysicals to be specialists. And this is why he kept absolutely under his control, because they were plenty bright enough really to outsmart him if he didn't make them a specialist. You see that in no time. But they would be outsmarting, they'd get a lot of big people to work for them. They're so smart that they would be the brains. So he turned those brains to his absolute special account. We find then that something goes on in our geography of our world. When we get to the north, the further north you go, the colder it's going to get, as I pointed out, there's something called annual variation. And around the equator of our Earth, the annual variation is only about 10 degrees from the coldest to warmest. If you get very cold, the cold pole of the northern hemisphere is in Zakhoyansk in Siberia. And there, the annual variation runs over 120 degrees between the coldest and the warmest. Now, the more annual variation you have, the more kinds of environment you have to live with. Therefore, the more adaptive you have to be, more inventive to get on. So as people got in a colder and colder country, they had to invent more ways of coping with the cold. So they invented then the cold, they invented their yurt, and they invented the ways of warming themselves with a fire and how to get the fire going, whatever it may be. We find them developing all kinds of tools and the cut. We find that historically, the northern people have very great advantage over the southerly people in great campaigns. If you were born in South Africa by Lake Victoria, you want to get the other side of the lake because there's something you know is over there, very good food of some kind. You don't want to walk around over the ends of the stumps and trying to have the trees. You find that the trees fall in the water, you can float. So it makes up a boat and go right across. So, if you live by Lake Victoria, you invent boats. If you lived in Asia here, by Lake Baikal, you would invent boats in the summer, but you invent skates in the winter. I want to point out that you'd have to deal with the different kinds of environment. So the more kinds of environment, the more inventive people became. This did not mean that they were more inventive, but because they had more occasion to employ their inventiveness. This is very important, not to make those differentiations saying the people of the South are dull, but that mistake could be made. I find then the people coming out of the north, down to the subcontinent here of India, there were people who came, the Chinese, the Mongols and so forth, coming. Time and again, India was invaded from the north, and they found enormous numbers of these people, crossbreeding people from coming there by boats from all over the place. India then, as the conqueror came in and overwhelmed him with his northerly tools and the southerly people, then the conqueror came and said, you've got a very beautiful religion, don't you let anybody change that lovely religion. And you've got a beautiful religion, don't let anybody change your religion. You've got beauty. You've got a lovely language, don't let anybody change that. They kept every kind of differentiation, have every kind of a caste of people. Any way you can differentiate, that's to keep conquered, keep divided. So there's no possible way to get together. That's been the grand strategy of the conqueror always. I simply want to get that. How it happened to be that we are specialized today simply is a consequence of the power structure, whether it's got to be corporate power structure or government. Always want them to keep everybody specialized, but also to keep them busy. So idle hands make trouble. So you find the politicians, everybody want to get more jobs out there to keep everybody busy. They may not be producing anything that you can eat, but keep them busy, keep them out of the way. So they may be digging up something, may make some money out of one of these days. So anyway, this is why specialization is here. I want to really understand it. But you know, all of us have been born to be comprehensivists. It's very important to know how this came into our economy and to our general way of thinking, because it's going to have to go. And I'm going to go through another historical set of events. Come back to Egypt. The data we now have, because I'm going back to the earliest real communication to us from people of the past of any important degree. So back 8,000 years, and we find the pharaoh and the average life expectancy, I'm told it'd be by the actuarians and all these statistics we can have, was probably somewhere 20 to 21 years of age. That's the average life. And in that 20, and you find in Alexander the Great a great leader at a very early age. Life was short and very powerfully actuated out. We find then the average human being found life so incredibly challenged, so disastrous, so not to go around, so diseased, that nobody could conceive of this life being worthwhile in its own right. So it's a very general, common way of looking at things, that this life is purely a test, an example, to see whether you can qualify to get in the great afterlife. Everything is afterlife. So if you were then were in Egypt in those times, and you know from experience that apparently there's only enough for the pharaoh to really have anything, therefore if you can get the pharaoh into the next life, everybody tells you he's your great leader, he's a god, he must be a god to have the difference the kind of life he has. He's in on that life support, and nobody else has it. So we hope that this semi-god can get over in the afterlife, and then if he can, he may bring us, his people, over there with him. So realizing that there's going to be, there's so much vandalism when people are absolutely desperately hungry to steal anything, they assume then that the pharaoh's going to need all the tools and anything you know about to be able to get over the next life, so to be able to organize things over there. So you build this enormous stone pile, the pyramid, and put the pharaoh and all the tools they're going to need, blow it, so try to keep the vandals out, so he has a chance to get over there and to get you over there with him. We have in all buildings what are called scaffolding, things you have to do to realize the building in due course. So the enormous amount of scaffolding and preconditioning work that has to be done to realize a building. So we have in building the pyramids enormous amount of work that had to do to get that stone cut, to get it moved, and get it piled one on top of the other. And so that whoever is the individual who the pharaoh trusts most to do the designing, the one seems to be most inventive and seems to organize things best. I'm going to call him the Leonardo of his period. The pharaoh picks him to design his building of his pyramid, so that the Leonardo type then sees that he's a very observant character and realizes there's such a principle of leverage. So he begins to use leverage to move, so man can move rocks much time, very much greater than their own muscle can move. And they get very inventive about one thing or another. And he sees his man dying of starvation and right on the job, and he sees that he's an observant man, so he sees that where the Nile is adjacent to the land, there's green. But where the water can't get at it, the green stops. So he then invents the idea of making ditches coming in from the Nile and irrigation, and he finds sure enough the green goes there. So he's able to take care of keeping his workers a little better food supply. Now the pharaoh dies, and the Leonardo, they put him in with the pharaoh to get to the next world a little earlier, to reward. And so there's another pharaoh coming along, and he needs his, and the people say he needs his
tomb also to get him ready the next night. So he gets his designer. And this designer finds that the irrigation ditches haven't gone. He recognizes those, and he's using the levers of the other man. There's a gradual accumulation with each one of the pharaohs and the successive generation of more and more know-how of tooling to get things ready, the things they have to do to do this thing in this life, which is the pyramid. It's just a scaffold to get you in the next life. You must understand that. It wasn't really meant for anything but to get you in the next life. So there's an enormous amount of make-ready for the make-ready, of tools and make the tools. And there's accumulation of it. Finally, there's so much tooling around, and so much know-how been accumulated, you didn't know that's going to go on in this life at all, because you're really working for the next life. But in this life, there's all this too. So, you know, we could take care of the pharaoh and also the nobles. So the nobles gather in on it, and this is the beginning of the second set of dynasties of Egypt. Finally, with each successive run, that's meant more activities, and therefore more inventiveness in this life. So there's an increase of the velocity which technology and know-how is beginning to increase. And finally, get to the point where there's so much know-how, they say, you know, we could take care of getting the pharaoh and the afterlife and the nobles and all the rich middle class. That's the beginning. That's the Greek and Roman period, where you find the mausoleums for all the wealthy middle class, with an enormous amount of slaves down below. The whole thing's absolutely slave. The extraordinary Greece and everything's there, but because of all the slaves, which is a substrate. Now we have then the more and more accumulation of getting ready to take care of the middle class and the nobles and the pharaoh. So much acceleration and know-how that suddenly we have a Buddha, and then 600 years later, possibly a Christ or Muhammad, whatever it be, some human beings were around and said, you know, we have enough capability to take care of everybody's afterlife. Really sort of redeeming of everybody. And so this was a fantastic new moment. So all the post-Christian period of building enormous cathedrals, everybody getting everybody ready for the afterlife. This proliferated the acquisition of the know-how very and multiplied it very rapidly. Points pretty quickly said, you know, we'll take care of the afterlife of everybody, but also enough to take care of the living life of the king. There's got to be a new moment of the divine right of kings here. Then there's such proliferation of capabilities that we take care of the afterlife of everybody and the living life of the king and the nobles, and that is the Magna Carta time. And suddenly we have such a proliferation of capability to take care of the living life, the afterlife of everybody, and the living life of the king, and the nobles, and the great middle class. And that is a Victorian period. It's really right up to the most of the older buildings of Philadelphia here. This is the great middle class coming in. Then suddenly we have such a proliferation of information that in this century we have really the Henry Ford kind of an idea, saying, you know, there's enough capability here to take care of afterlife for everybody, also the living life for everybody. Well, this is a very new moment, because up to this time, the people who produced the things were artists. They were skilled craftsmen. So that great middle class period that I was born into and I saw a great deal of, there was a cabinet maker downtown making the furniture. That's the only place you can get furniture. There's no other furniture. And somebody's making shoes and they're making clothes. But it's all tailored. Everything was one off for the rich patron. So in this newest area, you find together there were not enough artists to take care of everybody. So what happened was that the artists then, which really were the landlords, I really sense tend to be inventors, whatever they became inventors later. They then, the artists began to invent the tools, and the tools made the end product. And you suddenly had what I gave you here earlier today, energy getting on the ends of the levers, and the energy doing to take the muscle part of the work, so that you really have man engaged in with the tools embodying the know-how. This is the industrialization I spoke to you about coming in. So we're suddenly in an entirely new era. First time in all history where that first tool is the word, that literacy suddenly gone rapid in humanity, which was not there when I was young at all. People, the workmen I first worked with were very keen with their tools, doing their one-offs and so forth, but they had very small vocabularies, 100 words or so, and really primarily talked about how they spit and just 50% blasphemous or obscene. So I saw that all changing, and changed in an absolutely unexpected way. Nothing to do with the school system whatsoever. I've spoken to you before about the experience I had whether I like it or not, I was born the year that the Marconi invented the radio, but doesn't get into practical use until I'm 12. I was 3 years old and electrons discovered, but nobody pays any attention to that kind of stuff. And so I was also seven when the airplane first flies. Now, but just thinking about the radio side of things, I was 23 when the first time we got a human voice over the radio. It happened in the Navy, and I was in that operation. When I was 27, we had the first licensed broadcasting station in America. Very, very recent. And then later on, almost a generation later, comes TV. Now, I want you to think about our hearing. We can hear at 700 miles an hour. That's the speed of sound at a given temperature. But we see at 700 million miles an hour, exactly a million times faster. We can only hear very short distance. We can't hear outside of our atmosphere at all. These are airwaves. We can see, looking at that Andromeda a million years ago, we can see a million years ago. We can see a million years ago. The range of the information we get with our eyes compared to what we get with our hearing is approximately a millionfold right across the board. And furthermore, the hearing is in ethnic languages, special words. The seeing is in universal language. If you feel that mountain, you feel that water, you don't have to have a name for it. And the horse race is just the same in Japan as in France, literally. So simply get at the modification of information handling that came with this was incredible. Now we have historically, through all the long periods I've been giving you, we have the male, as with all mammals, the male tending to sweep out larger area than the female and the young. Whether it's herds or whatever it is, because the mother can't move around as well. She has to be near that young for the nurse. The male's free, so the male is an island and he operates that way. He goes hunting and he brings back for the tribe. We find the human man then going off large hunting area and bringing back things in for the woman to decide what she should do with it, whether she's going to cook it or skin it or breed it or what she may do. And she makes those decisions. But at any rate, throughout all the ages, Daddy has been the one who brought home the news. He brought home all the information about what's outside. And Daddy and Mom together told you about what Grandfather said, what the King says, and so forth. So everybody, who's the kids in the home, the only authority they have is the parents, absolute authority, about what it's all about. And the way Daddy or Mom said it, that's the way you say it. And Mom and Dad didn't hear too well, and they began to alliterate more and more, and they had a mouthful of somebody talking to them, they got a mouthful to say something strange. But gradually, the language became multifold and really very locally esoteric, and in local dialects. We have then the extraordinary thing. 1927 in May, Daddies were coming home, and the kid said, "Daddy, come in here in a hurry. Listen, radio, a man just flew across the Atlantic." Dad said, "What?" And he rushed in and listened, sure enough, a man just getting across the Atlantic. Daddy never brought home the news ever again. And this is absolutely unexpected historically. There's nothing said was going to happen. Nothing said we're going to have radio, nothing said we're going to have voice on radio, nothing said suddenly, because from this time on, Dad and Mom are listening to that box there talking, and quite clearly to the kids without Dad and Mom saying it, that the man talking over this authority, not Dad. He's bringing the news. This man telling Dad what the news is. There's no passing words about this, there's nothing in the remarks to the kids, but it was just suddenly, it was ipso facto, obvious to the kids, that Dad was not the authority. And this is the way the Saudi said, now the way the man got a job in the radio, got it by virtue of the versatility of his use of the vocabulary, and particularly the commonality of his language, to be understood by the many. So his diction was usually very, very much better than Daddy's or Mom. So this way, the Sahaja is saying it, so the kids began to say it, emulate. That's the way the Sahaja says it. They emulate Daddy, because he was a Sahaja. Now, this way, and Daddy and Mom realized that the kids were saying things a little differently than this, so they didn't want to be belittled, and they began to say it that way, too. This is the way the language changed. And it's just incredible. I went through my daughter growing up through that radio age. She was born the year of the Lindbergh flight, and let's know this thing happened. Now, with the television, it became very much more so. And suddenly with television, by this time, you've had your World War II, and everybody knows where Guam is, and they didn't know where Guam was before World War II. Suddenly everybody knows all the news about all the places around all the world, and all the maps are out there, and any kid can see it. The kids are all then, every human being full of compassion, every child full of compassion, they're sending news from all around the world, people are in a lot of trouble. So the kid with compassion is for the people in trouble. People in most trouble. You never get the kid be locally concerned about trouble. His heart goes to everybody. So suddenly we have a young world that's inherently concerned with the world, not with the local anymore. And I was brought up exactly opposite. I'll give you that map all divided there. My father, it took three months to get to Bombay, whatever it was. Well, we were really divided, and we were really being told locally that all I could get around on my feet. I didn't have a Later on, I got a bicycle, but we didn't have horses. We didn't have that kind of money. And I was simply being told that the people in the next town over here, too far for you to go there, but they're very dangerous people. They'd not go over there. They drink whiskey and have knives. And so you avoided that other town. You really were utterly preoccupied with the local, with your local people, the way the local authorities say that's where you did it. The customs were very easy to carry on. 1965, we have the Berkeley students at the University of California making the world news as the first university dissidents. And this proliferated very rapidly all over. But I met with that class, I met with many of their contemporary classes all around, who I think I told you I've been to over 500 colleges and universities around the world. And so I met that class, and we talked a great deal about their life together. The distance at Berkeley were the first American kids to be born with a television at home. It came absolutely in a different viewpoint. And so they are simply saying, I know Dad and Mom love me very much, and they're absolutely clear. I know they do. I love them to pieces too. But they just don't know what's going on. Dad's coming home from the shoe store, and they said, let's have a beer, and the things are really going on around this world out here. They began very quickly to feel not only the Dan Mom had nothing to do with going to the moon. There's something going on here, big patterns of politics, things. We don't have anything to do with it. We're going to have war. What is it all about? There's completely the velocity of the information and the ineffectuality of the individual to really respond and say what the action reaction would be to the feelings, the stimulation of the information. Not there. So there's more and more of a sense of disconnect, more and more of a sense of the older people being preoccupied in very short-sighted ways, assuming things would be very negative. And the kids saying, if we can go to the moon, we ought to be able to do anything. Intuitive, you got to say that. So we have a young world feeling all the world has nothing to do with love anymore or loyalty at all. It's simply a matter that I said every kid really did know how to think. And I told you I was being brought up, never mind what you think, pay attention to what the people know what it's about. That's why we send to school, that's why we have school. That everybody's being taught how to carry on and think with the army, the training, the very powerful disciplines. And everybody's having to accept it. But suddenly, this is no longer acceptable. So I found that young world came in, which is your world. Suddenly, a child had the thinking capability, but it's always been suppressed and told not to use it. But that now that you couldn't tell the kid not to use it, because he could see that Dad and Mom didn't know what's going on. So he spontaneously, I got to do my own thinking. I want you to realize what an extraordinary thing nature's done here. I point out then you need an umbilical cord while the child is in the womb, because you've got to get oxygen to purify that blood. The mother's got to do that, so you connect the child up, because they're not exposed to that oxygen out there. But the child is out of the womb, and then you cut the umbilical cord. Didn't mean it wasn't good, it was just now obsolete. And I think what nature really did here in a very extraordinarily big way the grand design of the universe is such then that we were given this mind, the capability to learn principles and so forth. We had to get to some kind of critical level of information where we really then, now we're supposed, and we're given an enormous cushion of resources, which by trial and error to make incredible numbers of things to really find and learn something. But we're now at a point where we've exhausted the cushion, and we're now where we have to really pass an exam. When we have then a new life gestated in the womb or in the egg, where when it really comes out, it's an incredibly critical moment that you're really going to make it. And whether you and I and humanity has really got enough stuff, we have plenty of information, but whether we have the capability to really take the initiative and do the logical things that need to be done, that is a big question. So in my estimate, nature now is actually humanity is in examination, in final exam, as to whether we really are going to have mind take over, because we're here for mind, not for muscle, and muscle is still completely in the saddle. Boy, what a critical moment we're in. With the $200 billion a year getting, it's being appropriated to get into the Armageddon. And less and less comfort on the part of the people who are the political leaders, but realizing the people themselves are being very difficult to contain, that the thinking thing is going on. So we have a very, very critical condition where somebody's liable to do something very drastic and could be all over. We're in then, for as far as I'm concerned, nature has had tradition through all those years of daddy and mom telling kids what to do. This is so, and going from absolute ignorance. If a child puts his foot down there, the snake's liable to bite him. He knows, Dad, don't do that, don't you? That kind of a fruit would poison you. The parents had to do an incredible number of things. They had to go on a great many hearsays, just in their good faith. This is my friend, they said they'd do it this way. There was an incredible amount of ignorance going along in the tradition. So you had tradition to help people consolidate the gains as we integrated information over all those years. But suddenly we got to the point where we learn enough by principle to be able to really proliferate the information. We have this video. My goodness, this kind of thing, nobody really, whatever the metaphysical, that you and I, the communication, lives forever. So this can be broadcast any distance. There's something new coming in, absolutely new. I say then, what nature did then, had tradition, was like metaphysics. It was, I call it a metabiblical cord to keep things under control until man got to the critical point where he knew enough to really be on his own. And nature now cut the metabiblical cord of tradition, and you're really on your own. You really understand what my feelings are about you at your age. making the kind of observation I am making as just trying to look at big patterns. There they are. I'm talking absolutely the truth. So I feel all my hope is in this young world, and it's things I note about it. And I note particularly about each child who is being born in the presence of less misinformation. I had an incredible amount of misinformation that came with that tradition. Given to me the greatest love, and I was absolutely convinced of the love that was giving it to me, and I did everything I could to take it on. There was no question, not a matter of anybody being malevolent at all. But I'm still got great much of that condition and reflex. It's very difficult for me to cope with things that you don't have not been exposed to. I talked about the a priori, what is natural, what looks natural to my granddaughter is very, very different than what looked at me. I was brought up when he can't fly at all, and to her, it's really, I think it'd be more obviously boring than anybody flies. And the brakes are going to work. She knows the brakes are going to work. Now, I see that each child being born is also born in the presence of a great deal more reliable information. Literally, for each one coming in, a whole lot more, and much more accessible. And the equipment of communicating to it is getting just better incredibly overnight. We're getting the communication relays around our world, and every day we get tighter little beautiful circuits, and again the palm of your hand, which you said, to have a great piano size thing. All the time, making it easier and easier for all of life to get that information. And that a young world that is so used to that all kinds of information, and the games that are played with the information, where there are novels and there are plays and they shoot. So the parents are worried that the kids are going to be misinformed by this thing. But the kid is not misinformed because he plays shoot grandmother like that. Doesn't mean hit grandmother at all. But the parents don't realize that they start really shooting grandmother. So the kids then can winnow out completely what is really information. And what really counts for them is not the plot of the play at all, but really sort of the technique, the way that all things are being done. The communication system itself fascinates them. So, and he realizes he can talk to them more effectively this way, and he'd like to use that kind of a tool. So I find then a young world coming through being less and less misinformed, more and more reliable information. And one of the most beautiful things of all is that we have our own ears, we have our own nose, and you don't tell the child, use your nose and smell. The kid says, Mom, I smell some smoke. The kid is spontaneously truthful, that's what he's essentially telling. And Mom says, Dad, don't say that man smells, that's your father's boss, he loses his job. The kid says, I didn't want my father to lose his job, what should I say? So, I'll just say, didn't recognize his distinguished perfume, huh? So the parents tell the children to lie. The kid is spontaneously truthful. The universe runs on the truth, not on lies. And absolutely rampant in our society, due to the lethalness of the working assumption, nowhere nearly enough to go around, is the concept then, I don't have to kill that man who's sitting on the life support. All I got to do is fool him, tell him there's something very important from out here, and then I go steal the lies away. Lying became one of the great tools of the survival. In many ways, it was more cruel than the killing. It really put people at incredible disadvantage when they know what. That way, no corporation trusts anybody. An incredible credit advantage. Everybody's lying. This is that older world that we're cutting the medieval the tradition cord from. And I now know, as we'll go on more and more, as you stay with me, as we get to the right efficiencies, which can be employed, we have the designing capability. I can say, by and large, I now know absolutely incontrovertibly the technique of how to take care of everybody, the highest standard anybody's ever known. We'll get into much more of that. I know how we've been through this project here with Matty Gable and the last scenario, the last seminar at Pennsylvania this year on energy. We now know exactly, it's all spelled out, the engineering is there, the resources are there, the know-how is there, completely spelled out, incontrovertibly, that by 1985 we can have all of humanity enjoying the same energy advantage enjoyed by United States, absolutely exclusively 1972, all of humanity enjoying that advantage while completely phasing out all fossil fuels and all atomic energy. We know how to do it. I now know then it's highly feasible to take care of all humanity and all its generations to come at the highest standard ever been known. So I know the politics invalid. I know the war is invalid. I know that the weapons are invalid. I know the lying is invalid. No, this isn't working. Nothing. I can understand how to get in all those things. And they're now through. But the question is, how quickly can we get all of humanity to know this though? That's one reason I'm awfully glad that we're having this particular video. I'm very glad I'm finding enormous numbers of young people asking me to elucidate what I'm saying. They begin to see, yes, that's apparently so. But we're in then for absolute revolution of humanity. And it can be two kinds. If it is one to pull the top down, or one of vengeance. That is not as powerful as it used to be. It was when the majority were have-nots. We now have the majority are haves. But if it's one to pull the top down and it's bloody, it's all over. If it's a matter then of pulling everybody up to a higher standard of living than anybody's ever known and doing it by design science revolution instead of by guns, But we use the information, employ the principles, reduce them into practice, use the tools, using technology, using industrialization to really work for everybody, then we'll survive. Unless we are spontaneously in that mood, within the next 10 years, I think humanity is all through. This is now time for us to stop and for tonight. I wanted to get to feeling some of the big patterns and movements at the outset. Then I'm going to go in with you a great deal into special case geometries, technology, industry, and so forth. So I'd like you to, by the time we finish this together, to really feel what design science is and how you do play world game. What I've been doing with it has been world gaming. What is the big patterns, and then what are our responsibilities? What ought we be doing going off of that? What is the main track at 90 degrees off here? So the next session I'm going to open up with precession some more, because you keep seeing that is the one that man knows the least about, and I'm going to really, I hope, make that very, very clear, so you really feel the power of that tool of precession. So thank you very much.